your ever-present pursuit of entertainment, education, and some adjective to be named later. The Home Star Army proudly presents TrekWest 5, a conglomerate podcast of science fiction, politics, humor, and pretty much whatever else we want to talk about. TrekWest 5 is brought to you in part by RocketWebDesign.com, custom web design at template website prices. DesignsByDeeDee.blogspot.com, your online home for all your digital scrapbooking needs. Need a home along the Wasatch Front? Contact Lisa DeBagere with Kirkham & Friends Real Estate. No one will work harder for your home. And thehomestarmy.com, blogging to the world since 2004. Your hosts for TrekWest 5 are Joey and Peter. Good evening and welcome to Podcast 62. I am Peter.
And I am Joey.
And we are joined this evening by the TrekWest 5 intern, Aaron.
As threatened over email by Pete.
Welcome to the podcast, Aaron. Okay, I remember why he's the intern now. Why we should treat him like dirt. Yes, there is the wave for those of you who didn't see it.
Which is basically everyone but you and I.
For those of you who did see it,
it was something special. Okay, so everybody have a good week?
Busy?
Yeah.
Busy?
Shut up. I can be busy.
You have a life that's absolutely full of rolling out of bed and eating nachos.
Hey, no. He had to move out of his apartment this week.
He hasn't yet. He's going to have to tonight.
Oh, but he was in preparation.
Packing all my stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't buy it for one second that he's prepared at all for this.
Oh, man. You are such a pessimist. Okay, we've had some people send in some stuff this week.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, a couple of non-necessarily episode-related type stuff.
Okay.
And we've got two people. We've got Flamingo and Listener Sigh.
All right.
Now, do you have a preference as to which we do first?
I think Listener Sigh, he's been with us longer, so we ought to give him the...
Let him go first?
Yeah.
All right. Flamingo, it's nothing against you.
Ladies first.
Oh, and whoever we do last is going to be the one who seems like is the most prominent.
Yeah.
Maybe we shouldn't do any of them.
Wait, hand one to me and I'll read one, you read the other. We'll just do them simultaneously. Go ahead with Listener Sigh, I think.
Listener Sigh, okay. All right. Hey, guys. First and foremost, as always, thanks for putting out such a funny and engaging podcast. It has certainly enhanced my viewing of The West Wing. On behalf of the podcast, you're welcome. Let's see here. As I think I said over Twitter, I have never seen the show before, but had heard many good things and very much wanted to see it. So when you switched over from TNG, it was a great excuse to dive full in, and I asked for the box set at Christmas. I have now watched up to the end of the third season. I got a bit episode crazy a few weeks back and raced ahead of your podcast. But I'm now enjoying listening to them retrospectively. It is giving me great insight into elements of the show I missed on my first viewing, and I really love hearing you pull all the details apart. By the way, you're not the first to mention that. We did it ourselves, like just trying to cram as many episodes in as you can at a time.
Yes.
New York Maria did it as well. Okay. He continues, I have just listened to the end of podcast 59 and have come down well and truly on the side of thinking Ainsley is brilliant. Although based on my reading and viewing about American politics, the big stuff tends to feature quite heavily on our news broadcasts over here. I think I would more likely lean to the Democrat rather than Republican side of the political spectrum. Perhaps a centrist with Democratic leanings. But nevertheless, I really like how Ainsley is written as a highly intelligent and articulate force to be reckoned with who can back up her opposing ideas with a great deal of rationality and sense. Of course, the fact that she is gorgeous doesn't hurt. I much prefer her as she is in the West Wing rather than after she switched careers and became a crime scene investigator over in Miami. She is way more annoying there. You are quite right. I'm not sure how much of our politics in the UK gets transmitted over the pond to you guys, but we are now only a couple of weeks away from our general election. On May 6th, the three main political parties, the Conservatives, who most closely resemble the Republicans, Labour, who used to resemble the Democrats but are now much more like the Conservatives than they would ever care to admit, and the Liberal Democrats, who are kind of the in-between party but don't have enough support to win, are all going to the polls up and down the country to see who will form the next government. We actually next week had our first ever historic televised leaders debate. Wow. With another one last night and the final installment due next Thursday. Finally, it seems the Brits have realized the age of television is here to stay. They were pretty interesting, as the leader of the Liberal Democrats, who prior to the first debate many people would have been unable to pick out of a lineup, was almost unanimously declared the winner of each. We also recently had a major political scandal over here concerning the expenses that politicians had been charging back to the taxpayer. True to British form, rather than something really seedy, but at least interesting like prostitutes or drugs, one politician had charged to his expense account the cost of having his moat cleaned whilst another had a floating duck house built to go in his pond. Whilst it is unacceptable that the taxpayer was made to pay for all this, gotta love how twee and quintessentially British it all is.
Quintessentially is the word.
Quintessentially, thank you. Much easier to say than actually read and try and pronounce, let me tell you. Anyway, in one of our last podcasts, you asked if I would explain the difference between our two houses of Parliament over here. And as you have been so gracious in indulging my questions about your system, I would be more than happy to. The first chamber is the House of Commons, which looks like this. Now hold it up here for okay. Joey and Aaron to see.
Are you going
to
link that?
We could probably link that. We can't really link it since it was in the email. So maybe...
You can forward the email to me and I'll post them.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe we put in some links or we put in the images themselves. Maybe. We'll see.
Okay.
He says, it is roughly equivalent to your House of Representatives and is where the Prime Minister, currently Gordon Brown, until he takes a hammering in the election next month, and the rest of his government and the opposing parties, politicians all sit and bicker and thrash out debates and laws, etc. The upper chamber, however, is the House of Lords, which looks like this.
Okay.
Everybody see that there? Yeah. Everybody? Yeah. Looks kind of ornate. Pretty fancy.
Yeah.
This is where laws that have been put together by the government are sent to be ratified and checked. If they do not pass the House of Lords, they are sent back to the Commons to be altered and resubmitted. There is a curious rule, though, that the Lords can only block a bill three times before it has to become law.
Wow.
So a tenacious enough government can get through whatever it needs to as long as it has enough time. There is some controversy with the House of Lords, the members of which are all actually a lord by title, as they can often be hereditary peers, which means that just because their father or grandfather was appointed to be a member several years ago, they are also automatically become
interesting.
One.
Interesting.
Yes, very interesting. So it almost kind of sounds like they're not even elected. Hang on, let me finish this off here. This is slowly being stopped, but is still significant enough issue to warrant mentioning. Anyway, that's more than enough for me. Look forward to your next show. Best wishes, Cy. That was
awesome.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's definitely
fantastic. But I'm fascinated by this idea of the House of Lords, which is this group, almost, let's just call them an elite part of society.
It's an aristocracy, literally. Yeah.
It doesn't...
I always thought that... I knew it was called the House of Commons and the House of Lords, but I thought the House of Lords was just, you know, a meaningless phrase that had been applied somewhere along the way. I didn't realize that it actually still ran like an aristocracy. That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very, very
cool. You have to think really carefully about who you vote in.
If we're wrong about this, Cy, about the fact that the House of Lords aren't actually elected, let us know. But fascinating.
Definitely.
Just fascinating. He followed up with another email.
Oh, wow. Great.
That is quite interesting.
This is awesome. Before this, all I knew about Great Britain was, well, what's on Doctor Who? So
I'm going to present this down here so that you guys can look at this. In his email, he says, "Many apologies, guys. The picture I claimed in my last email as being the British House of Commons is, in fact,
Congress.
The Canadian House of Commons. ours looks like this."
Oh, wow. Look at that.
They are packed in there, aren't they?
They really are.
Just like sardines. So, that room has got to be excruciatingly hot in the summer.
Oh, man. Can you imagine? I bet they are really motivated to either pass the law or vote it down and get out of there.
I've seen a couple of times where these from the House of Commons where they're going and going, and it is so ridiculously loud. And this is why. They're just crammed in there, such a small room with so many people. He finishes and says, "The Canadian flag probably should have tipped me off." You can see it better in the email, but if you look right there,
oh, yeah,
there is a Canadian
flag. Doesn't show up quite as well in black and white.
No, not so much. Thank you for catching that. Otherwise, this adds a little something extra special about the House of Commons, doesn't it? Okay, good email.
I wonder if that's like a annex room when they're not using it.
Okay.
Flamingo.
Moving on to Flamingo. This, this is going to be controversial, everybody. Controversial. Okay. The subject of her email starts out with, by the way, she has two. She says...
Oh, I read one of these.
"Evidence of climate change."
I read this one.
she said, "Enjoyed this week's podcast, but had the unsettling experience of agreeing with you two on several salient points."
Don't worry, Flamingo. I'm sure it won't happen too often.
Just lie back and just enjoy it. "Until the discussion on climate change. I'm thrilled to rise to the challenge and explain why I believe climate change is a very real phenomenon. However, I need to put a little thought into my argument. Really, there's so much evidence out there. Where do I start?" She says her husband's heading out of town. She's basically going to be a single mom for the next few days, and she's not really sure. I said, "You know what?" I responded back and said, "You know what? Take your time. Really, just put together a really good argument for us. We would love to hear it. Whenever you get to it, you know, bring it to us."
I just want to clarify. I am not doubting that climate change is real. I am doubting that humanity is the cause.
Changing your story there, are you, Joey?
Go back and listen to what I said.
Yeah, he said that.
Don't back him up. He hates you.
I'm the intern. I got to back one of you up.
Me. He's the guest host here.
I fear him more, though.
Well, that's true. You really should fear him more.
You'd kill me, but it'd be quick and, you know, relatively painless.
Okay, so let's go to her email. I was surprised she actually sent this in. I wasn't expecting this for another week or two.
Okay.
So here is her treatise, or at least a partial beginning of it. Wow, what a huge topic. Because this is a comment to a podcast and not a doctoral thesis, I'm going to treat climate change as a given and focus on whether climate change is man-made phenomenon. I'm willing to concede that.
Absolutely.
I think we both agree on that. I never stood a chance of reaching anyone who disputes that weather patterns are changing. However, if you are curious, there's a lot of good info here. She includes a link to... www.sunysuffolk.edu/mandias.
Wow. We'll just...
No, it ends right there. Just scroll down on the right, and apparently we're going to get a lot of information on that. She moves on. "First, I'd like to address Joey's objection that so many of the scientists putting forward evidence of man-made climate change are geologists rather than meteorologists. Sure, weather patterns are tracked by meteorologists, but the effects of weather really are best studied by geologists. It's a gory example, but depending only on meteorologists to analyze the long-term effects of weather is like sending a hematologist to a crime scene. They can only tell you part of the story. The strongest piece of evidence out there that climate change is caused by humans is a model-based study from the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They looked at the characteristics of carbon emissions from natural sources, example, the ocean, plants, volcanoes, etc., and the characteristics of carbon emissions from the burning of fossil fuels. Then they created a model predicting climate change given a world where the only carbon emissions were from natural sources. The climate changes resulting from this model weren't accurate. Then they took that model, layered in the man-made carbon emissions, and found that the climate changes predicted in this model almost exactly matched the recorded climate changes. There are other studies out there that point in the same direction, but none so compelling as this. Still, I recognize that if you don't trust the science behind the study, if you think these scientists have some ulterior motive, there isn't anything I can say that will convince a skeptic. At that point, I can only, one, appeal to common sense and ask if you really think that the 6.8 billion people on this earth and their 600 million passenger cars, that doesn't count shipping trucks, planes, ships, etc., aren't negatively impacting the environment. Occam's razor would seem to dictate that we at least consider it's a possibility. Point two, apply to your sense of practicality. I believe it's imperative we become more conservative about how we use our natural resources, and I don't care how we get there. I'm an ends justifies the means kind of girl. Throw climate change out the window and just look at the issue as a political one. Even if we pursue untapped oil within our own borders, fossil fuels are a finite resource and are being consumed at a greater rate every day. When they begin to run out, do we want to have already eased into an economy that is less dependent on fossil fuels, or do we want to be, even more than we already are, at the mercy of foreign governments for our oil supplies? Really, I did try to keep this short. Not sure if you find any of these arguments compelling, or if it's realistic for you to include this in the podcast. You really have no idea what we're willing to include in the podcast.
They let me on.
Certainly won't be offended if you can't. Regardless, thanks for listening, and happy Earth Day. I actually would concede her second point that she makes here.
Which is
the one talking about the sense of practicality. We need to start conserving the way in which the natural resources that we're using. We need to conserve them more and move to a system of energy that is not just coal and oil based,
okay,
or fossil fuels based. Which I suppose could be. Isn't coal still considered fossil fuel?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I could get behind that one completely. Absolutely, I'm willing to. I think that there are other means of energy out there that we maybe haven't discovered a better way to use them yet. And so I would certainly love to see us getting into that realm.
I'd be all for us finding alternative sources of energy. My problem is that there is no such thing as a costless energy source.
Oh, agreed. Agreed. Yeah, there is a cost. Even if it's solar energy, let's take solar energy or wind power. The cost, in my opinion, is space.
Well, so wind power is a great example where a lot of people think wind power is essentially free, right? You build the windmill, and then at some point it pays for itself. I think is what a lot of people would argue. Well, they're starting to realize that putting up these wind turbines all over these, you know, in these places is affecting the ecology of the land behind the wind turbines.
Sure, it changes the way in which wind flows.
Right, and so it's changing the plant life, which affects the animal life, which affects, you know, I mean, so there's always this cascading effect. You know, you also raised the issue of solar power. We produce so much poison when we make a solar panel. like the byproducts of the process to make a solar panel, there is a lot of crap that comes out of that that we don't want to deal with. Maybe look at nuclear energy. That's obviously got huge, huge issues, right? There's a massive potential downside.
Hmm. Nuclear.
I was very careful to say nuclear. So I would be more than happy for us to find alternative energy sources. I just don't want us to be... I feel like the people who are arguing fossil fuel usage is causing climate change are really trying to say there are all these free ways of getting energy out here that we should be pursuing, and I don't see it. You know, even like the geothermal stuff and the, you know, they've talked about putting turbines in the ocean and letting the ocean tide generate this, and again it would have the same kind of effect that they're saying as
possibly
the wind
yeah.
turbines, that it'll affect the ecology of the land around it.
Yeah, there is no zero cost at all.
Short of wiping out 2/3 of the human race, I don't see any way for us to get away from damaging our environment.
I actually do see a way that there is a form of energy that I think that we could utilize. We have, at least in my opinion, there are a lot of, what are they called, where they keep animals? Pounds?
Pens?
The like a pound where you know you have
shelter,
an animal shelter. Thank you. We put up some sort of system. They're going to have to feed the animals anyway. So instead of having them just sit around, we put them on some sort of treadmill or some sort of wheel that they have to be moving on, and that would generate some energy, would it not?
It would. I'm not sure how much.
There would be a bit of a byproduct associated with it. I would imagine some sort of gaseous release from the animals. At least that's what happens when I work out. There's, you know, a byproduct there. But I think that's a pretty clean way of getting some new energy out there.
Well, you know, the Matrix did propose an option, which is to use humans as a power source.
Yes, our own body heat.
Anyway, that is my biggest concern, is that a lot of the people that I've talked to and that I see on the television and things like that that are talking about these things don't seem to realize everything's going to have ramifications, and
sure.
You just have to balance it.
Absolutely. But my concern is the fact that I don't think we've tried hard enough, and I say that as a guy who is in no way, shape, or form... trying, or as a scientist who, you know, I'm not the guy who would ever come up with the ideas, but we created the internal combustion engine, which is powered by fuel. Like, we burn stuff. That's how we get energy.
Right.
Whether it be coal or fossil fuels, we burn stuff and we get energy off of it. And that seems to be the only way in which we've ever really tried to get energy. I would like us to maybe try something new. I would like people to start trying something
new. I think
new.
You're wrong. I think people have been and are out there trying things new, and they just haven't had
enough.
A whole lot of success.
I think they found something that...
There's no money in it.
I think they found something that worked out incredibly well, and so they decided they didn't need to continue looking.
So is this something the government should be sponsoring?
Not necessarily.
Because I don't see private industry paying
for
this.
Yeah, it's the people who would work hard enough to actually achieve it are the people who would only do it if it paid off for them.
Yeah, I understand the argument of the free market, you know, where are you going to find it? But if you do find it and you're that one guy and all of a sudden you have the power source or the means for which to gain the energy from that, then that I could see you making a lot of money off of that.
I will just respond to the IPCC thing just to say that I have read a lot of sources that say every single scientist on the IPCC board is politically motivated. Obviously, I don't know any of them personally, so I can't make a judgment call. But people that I have come to respect their intelligence have made the claim that the board of the IPCC is run by a bunch of political scientists, and they know there's money in saying, oh, we're destroying the Earth. Saying that gets them money. And so there's a motivation to, you know, to make the argument.
Sure. So you would fall into the realm of the one who says you think that they are politically motivated in what they're doing.
I have reason to believe that okay. they are. Now, again, I'm with you. I think I agree with Krista.
Flamingo.
I've forgotten. Sorry, I forgot. I would agree with her that, and with you, that you can throw all of that aside and say, look, let's just think about it. There's 6 billion of us. We're doing a lot of pretty destructive stuff.
We're doing something.
It's going to have an impact. Sure. Absolutely grant it. I just think that we need to be just as rational about all the alternatives that we're looking at as people are being about the fossil fuel resources. And a perfect example is I've got a coworker who drives a gas electric hybrid, and he is so proud of himself that he drives it mostly on the electric. And he advertises this. He walks around our area with 75 people in it, telling at the top of his voice how he drove to work today completely on electric, and we should all praise him. I don't think he says that, but that's the implication. So I recently came across an article that said the coal that we burn to produce the electricity that is powering his electric car is far more damaging to the environment on the whole than the use of oil. So, you know, it's just we need to make sure that we're looking at things.
Yeah, but he's not charging his car up at night.
Yes, he is.
Then I don't understand. From what I understood of hybrids, the engine in them is the one that powers the batteries that you can then run off of when you're not actually using the engine.
He's the one telling me he's charging it up at night, so I don't know. I don't own a gasoline electric hybrid.
Yeah, neither do I. I don't know enough about it, but I was under the impression that they
I know there are ones that charge the electrical batteries when, for example, you brake. They turn that braking force actually into generating electricity and store that in the batteries. But he's telling me that he's got one that he charges at night, and is so happy that he drove to work on the battery power that he charged from his house the night before.
His electric bill must be through the roof.
Yeah.
Granted, well, I've got a house and an electric bill, and I look at it, and it's not that bad. But putting your car on that, that's got to be...
expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really expensive. Well, I think that we're having an effect, too. I don't think that it is the unbelievably... mind-altering, earth-shaking, like it's completely destroying the planet thing. But I think that we're definitely having an effect. And I think that we could be smarter about the way that we go about things.
I agree.
Yeah.
You know, anybody who doesn't feel like we're having an effect on the environment, I would challenge them to watch a show on the History Channel called Food Tech, where they go into the behind the scenes of how all of our food is produced. And they show these massive pig farms, they show these massive duck farms, and they show all of the waste and stuff that's produced. Yeah. It is mind-blowing to think about the effect that that's going to have. You know, it's again, it's not free. Nothing is free. There's always a cost.
Yeah. Aaron, did you want to chime in at all on any of this here?
I like to think that free bacon is free.
I believe the cost is tallied in your arteries, sir. Okay. Good comments, Flamingo. Thank you very much for doing that.
Yeah.
If you would like to refute anything that we have said or add to your argument, or anybody else would like to chime in on this, we would be more than happy to revisit this issue.
And if Absolutely. You have any suggestions for alternative energy sources that we could research, go ahead and send them in. I'll patent them for you and get back to you on that.
Yeah. Patent pending. My animal shelter energy idea.
The animal treadmill.
Okay. Let us move on then to principles of an American life.
You're making that pause longer on purpose, aren't you?
I'm emphasizing the appropriate amount, sir. We are going to be covering the 12th Amendment tonight. And Joey, you are going to read the text of this. I don't know. Do you want to just summarize? This is really, really long.
It's really long.
I think it's maybe the longest one.
It's definitely the longest one we've hit so far.
Should we just summarize it? So it's a lot of wordy stuff that I just want to, frankly, skip.
Do you want to summarize it? I'm not sure I could summarize it.
Okay. The 12th Amendment is the Electoral College Amendment. Can we just call it that?
Okay.
But this is the one that discusses about how a president gets elected.
So it used to be that, if I understand correctly, it used to be that you had all these guys running for president, and the Electoral College voted for anybody not in their state that they wanted to vote for, and the guy who got the most votes was president, and the guy who got the second most votes was vice president.
Right.
And the House of Representatives resolved any ties.
Correct, yeah.
This amendment said, instead now you vote for a president, and you vote for a vice president.
Which, by the way, this amendment came in 1804. So before 1804, this is how they dealt with the electing of the president.
Right. And it also clarified some things about what happens if we can't decide who is the president in the meantime, who actually gets to, you know, be in power and things like that.
Actually, interesting thing that I found is that the president didn't take control until March something
4th,
or other.
March 4th, yeah.
Back in the day. And it wasn't until later on that they decided, okay, that seems like too long, and they moved it up to January 20th. Okay.
I'm not sure I'm in support of the 12th Amendment.
Well, it seems as though, and I don't know if this is the right phrase, but we've nerfed it. We've changed it. Obviously, the way in which we now do things is such that we don't have... we have a president and a vice president who are of the same party. They're on a ticket.
Right.
And so there's never any sort of...
like, we've socially engineered our way around it, right?
Yes. Yes. You've explained this to me once before. The reason they got away from... the first place guy is president, the second place guy is vice president, is because they could be of opposite parties, and you therefore have your opponent sitting in there finding ways to, you know...
Well, and more to the point, the losing party could potentially become president, right?
Yes,
they're
absolutely
in line to become president.
They are the next in line.
But I kind of like that. In fact, I would support an amendment that said... whatever party the president comes from, the vice president has to come from the opposite party.
What about a three-party system?
We're never going to get to a three-party. Has to come from a different party.
The chief of staff.
Has to come from a different party. You cannot have the president and the vice president come from the same party. I would love to see that.
You know, it's okay, but for... really, the vice president has... no power except to make a deciding vote in the Senate.
And
so
that's no power?
How often does it come down to that? How often have you heard of the vice president having to go up to the Hill and saying, okay, I cast my vote?
I don't know that they tell us every time it happens.
I don't think it's happening that often.
Okay.
So my point in saying, by putting the person of a different party as the vice president... is really just saying, okay, well, if the guy who actually is president is out for some reason, we're now just going to have another guy supplanted in there. I think that would cause more damage than it would help us. Because then you're going to have the vice president, who is now president, come in here and put in all of his staff to replace all of the other staff that are in there. I think that that would cause too much trauma.
I don't know. I still think there's some merit to this idea of whatever party is in power, they should have to be worried about somebody nipping at their heels. We get these presidents in, and we pretty much vote them two terms all the time, right?
Sometimes.
When was our last one-term president?
George Bush.
Senior?
Yeah.
Was he only one term?
He was only one term. He was in between Reagan and Clinton.
I thought he was two terms in there.
And before him was Carter.
Carter.
And I suppose you could say that Ford was only one term.
Yeah.
And so therefore, would Nixon only be considered one term? I don't know. I'm joking, but... He was technically reelected.
Yeah. Anyway, do you understand what I'm saying, though? Where
I don't see the gains.
We build dynasties, and that was something the Founding Fathers said, don't build dynasties.
Yes, but we kick them out after two terms.
Yes, but they can do so much damage in 8 years.
So what does the vice president, being from an opposite party, what does it gain you?
I don't know. I have to think that the vice president, just being the vice president, has some political clout that he can use and he can manipulate.
Absolutely he can. But doesn't that just put us into more of a house divided kind of situation? Where we can't manage to do anything because we're always trying to trip up the other guy?
I often think that we'd be better off if we would just manage to do nothing.
Oh, jeez. I disagree wholeheartedly.
The choices we make always seem to be the wrong ones, so we'd be better off not making any choices.
I think if that kept happening, that the choices that the president started to make would be closer to a bipartisan, you know, maybe I'm not using
consensus.
The right word. Yeah. He would begin to shift his ideas more towards something that can be accepted by both sides.
You're living in a land of rainbows and puppies. That's never going to happen.
I can't see that happening either. Let's talk here about the Electoral College. For those people who don't actually know what it is, essentially, when you cast a vote for the President of the United States, you are not actually casting a vote for the President of the United States. You are voting
an elector.
An elector. Who then chooses to vote. It is the Electoral College that actually votes for the President of the United States. Which is why we have the fun sort of circumstance where the popular vote, or the guy who actually gets more of the numerical vote by the American people, may not necessarily win the election. Because the Electoral College ends up being such that he doesn't get the right number of votes.
Yeah, what is it? There's like 15 or 22 states, something like that. You win those 22 states and you're president, no matter what else happens in the rest of the country.
Right, right. So the... I think President Bartlett in the West Wing, he didn't win the popular vote.
Right, 48%.
Yeah. So anyway, the Electoral College, technically those men don't have to, or women, those people, don't actually have to go with the vote that the American people make. So if within the state of Utah, how many electoral votes do we have?
Five.
And that's based off of the number of, is that based off the number of congressmen?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So they can choose to vote whomever they would like to, but that would cause an unbelievable amount of unrest. And so they all have always voted for the way in which the state, the majority of the state, ended up voting. Have I missed anything here? Maybe I glanced over too much.
I think you covered it.
Okay. Anything more we want to say about the electoral system for the president?
No. It's...
You don't have a good enough idea.
Right, exactly.
That's why you can't say
anything.
That's
right.
Finally, we've got him to shut up, everybody!
I'm gonna respond now. I'm reminded of... I think it was Churchill that generally is credited with saying, democracy is the worst system of government except for all the others.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's a stinky situation, but yeah, we got nothing better. You know, I've looked in the past at some possible alternatives. You know, one of them that they talk about is an instant runoff election. If you want to really get into like political science theory and how elections work and stuff like that, go look on Wikipedia about the instant runoff election. You will spend like the next 3 weeks of your life over your head in trying to understand the theory of what they're even trying to talk about. It's very deep stuff.
Problem with Wikipedia is I always end up, you know, coming across Klingon Christmas Carol.
Everything leads you back to Klingon Christmas Carol somehow.
All right, let's go ahead and get started into the episodes. We are going to be covering episodes 13 through 16 of The West Wing Season 2. We're going to start with episode 13, Bartlett's Third State of the Union. Joey, would you read the summary, please?
While a live TV show is broadcast from the West Wing following the State of the Union, the staff must covertly deal with a hostage situation in Colombia. CJ learns that a special guest at the State of the Union has a black mark on his record that could taint the administration, and Ainsley Hayes is afraid to meet the president in person. Good episode. I like this one.
Yeah, I like this one as well. I have nothing against this episode in any way. I thought they did a good job. I liked seeing kind of the, you know, behind the scenes with all of the... This is how I really think the State of the Union should really be. Like, the last one we saw, like, he starts out with, "I say thee yay, Toby Ziegler, and I say thee yay, Sam Seymour." It's like, what the... How stupid that is. I believe that the State of Union is literally, like, last-minute writing, throwing stuff in and trying to cram in this thing that you want to do, this thing that you want to announce, this...
So I believe that's it's how more it should
about,
be?
No, I believe that's how it actually is.
Okay.
Versus some neat and tidy little script that they've managed to get together and, okay, it's done, out the door.
So I think I've mentioned before my terrifying, paralyzing fear of public speaking.
Yes, yes, I know well about it.
I think you know more about it than probably anyone.
Yes.
One of the ways I try to mitigate that is... If I'm giving a 10-minute talk, I try to spend at least 10 hours in preparation. Jeez. Writing, memorizing, preparing flashcards. So for every 10 minutes of talk that I have to give, I try to spend 10 hours preparing for it in advance. So the idea of going out there and they're like handing you the final speech as you're walking out there just terrifies me, even though I'm watching a TV show and my heart rate jumped up and I got sweaty.
Well, I think it would be different because, number one, it's not as though this is a new concept or a new idea or anything like that. You have been a part of the entire building up of what the speech is. And, more to the point, you've got the speechwriter who knows how to write for you, knows your voice, and can put it in the way in which you would be comfortable speaking it.
But not knowing exactly what word comes next in the sentence when I'm up there speaking would be the part that would terrify me. Not having the whole thing memorized.
Mm, okay, okay.
I mean, if I can't give it backwards,
I'll not take your fear away from you. I really won't. There are times when I'm reading some of our listener emails cold, and I think I do a pretty good job.
Other than quintessential.
Yeah. I mean, there are the few stumbling words that I have, but I think that that's a symptom of the lateness of the hour in which we're doing this.
Okay.
Plus, I'm not a great public speaker. I mean, I'm good at it, I'm okay at it, but I'm not a great public speaker like what I believe our presidents are.
Okay.
Is that fair to say?
Our current president, I would agree with you. Our last president, I would say that public speaking was not a strong suit for him.
I don't think he had a strong suit.
Oh. That blue one he wear, that was pretty. That was a pretty strong suit. You know, don't take that one away from him.
Anyway, it was just something that, right off the bat, I'm like grabbing my chair and
This one definitely seemed more tense and more stressful, and in my opinion, that's just how I believe that the State of the Union really actually is.
I think you're right. I agree. You have Josh down at the polling center?
Yeah.
Pitching a fit?
This is the comic relief of the...
This is a little bit how I imagine you probably are as a manager.
No, not as much. Not anymore.
Okay.
There were times when I was just coming unglued, but that was because I didn't know anything. I didn't understand how things work.
Gotcha.
I understand how things work. I know how certain things should be. I know how long they should take. You know,
well,
isn't the unknown.
Is Josh's problem here too, though?
Yes, it is. So.
So you're very Josh-like, Pete.
Thank you. That's one of the highest compliments. That's one of the nicest things you've ever said to me. I just quoted Sam there. For me, I just sort of discount this whole thing. I mean, it's fun with the, you know, with Joey,
yeah,
back there, Joey Lucas, and I just think it's fun.
It is fun.
I don't really have anything to say about that.
They keep going on and off the Meet the Press episode. They're going to commercial break. There are people coming and going.
Well, it's not Meet the Press. It's Capital B.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. I'm sorry. It's Capital B.
Which I would imagine is probably some fictitious show.
Yeah.
It's probably not a real show.
I think it's Meet the Press in the West Wing universe because they can't actually say Meet the Press or something.
No, they say Meet the Press.
Do they?
Yeah. Okay. I know that CJ says it at some point because she's like, and then we're going to end up on Meet the Press, which is like the hardest interview that you can ever get, and nobody's watching the show. So yeah, this isn't Meet the Press. It's just a political talk.
Sorry, you're right. It was Capital B. Anyway, so it just made me wonder, what would it take for you to let a camera crew in to film and to interview and stuff like that in a normal workday in your office?
Wow.
Like if your bosses came to you and said, "Hey Pete, we really want to do this. We think it'll be great publicity and stuff like that." What's that for?
You're getting the slow clap, brother. You surprised me with that question. I did not see that one coming at all. Well done. You know, I don't know. I think I would probably be okay with it. I think I would scratch my nose a whole lot less. I think that I would be okay if I was the subject of the filming or like
the
job,
whole company,
the entire company,
and they have unfettered access, so you can't control the message. You can't.
Oh, if I can't control it, no.
You honestly think you can't? You could ever control it?
Sure. They got to hand me the videotapes before they walk out the door. You're darn right.
Okay.
Or you use my cameras. You know, that kind of thing.
Gotcha.
If I didn't have some sort of control and they truly had unfettered access, meaning they could walk in at any time, like when I'm chewing out one of my subordinates, no. No, I would have to say no to that.
Okay.
There has to be a barrier, I think. And rightly so, there's a barrier for these people as well.
There is, yeah.
They wouldn't be allowed to just walk
there's
over
a stage
into the next.
And they're...
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there's a barrier, or... The fact that CJ's on television without pants would be a much bigger deal. They throw out a term here. When Charlie is talking to Mrs. Landingham, Mrs. Landingham's asking her, is it possible that CJ's out there without pants on?
Smokeless.
And, smokeless. Have you ever heard that before?
No. Only through the context of this show.
Okay. I don't even remember hearing it the first time. When I watched the episode, I was like, smokeless? What a weird word to describe... that condition.
I don't know. Yeah. The only word I know that's even close to that is going commando, but that's really when you don't wear underwear.
It's the opposite of what CJ is doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's like the full Monty and things like that.
And how did Miss Landingham know?
Well,
is she just like...
I don't know. Maybe she... I don't know.
Yeah.
One thing that bugged me about... the State of the Union, is this idea of a Blue Ribbon National Commission. And they like to use those words like those, Blue Ribbon, because it makes it sound really important. Like, as though using those makes me feel, oh, wow. Oh, wow, this isn't just a normal commission. This is a Blue Ribbon Commission. This is going to be extra special.
It's, you know, you have a bunch of speech writers and they're taking poetic license.
I just think it's
stupid. They're trying to paint a picture.
Now, I get what the whole idea behind it, because Toby, I think, talks about it once we get into, what, the war at
home?
Yeah, he really lays into, you know,
Andy,
why it is that the Blue Ribbon Commission is so important and why we've got to have it. And I get that. That makes sense. I'm willing to buy that. But just the whole idea of, let's call it a blue ribbon something, just sounds stupid. It's, in my opinion, they're insulting my intelligence by calling it that.
Okay.
That's my opinion.
I'm not contending against your opinion. I'll just say, okay.
At this point.
One of the things that bugged me is this kerfuffle over this police officer who 17 years ago had a reprimand in his jacket for excessive force.
Yeah.
Now, I know I've said some disparaging things about police officers on this podcast, but I want to just be clear once again that I really do respect what most of them are trying to do. Every once in a while, I feel like I get the bad egg. But for the most part, I think police officers are out there really trying to do the right things.
Yes.
And if he's had one reprimand in 17 years, who cares?
The trouble is that it's a black person that he did it to.
I don't care.
And so it looks bad.
If it was a black cop doing it to a white guy, I don't care.
Yeah, I think you and I are intelligent enough to be able to say, okay, this probably isn't racially motivated.
It's an isolated incident. One time in 17 years?
Absolutely agreed. And especially considering the fact that it was thrown out by, you know, the civil
courts.
Court, the criminal court. I mean, it was just, it was clear once the Detective Sloan actually explains, look at me. This guy was, you know, in track and field. He was 6'2", 190 pounds. Do you think that I can catch him if his leg isn't already broken? Oh, and by the way, he broke my hand and my nose while trying to cuff him. Nobody wants to mention that.
Yeah.
I had a problem with this because CJ treats him poorly. CJ interrogates him over this matter and just treats him as though, you know what, you should have told us that this thing was here. Absolutely freaking not. It is her fault or somebody else in the communications department fault for not properly vetting this guy.
He just goes along with it.
Once again, that they don't bother to do their job when it comes to vetting their personnel that they're going to use as some sort of standard bearer.
He just rolls with this. I don't think I would. I think I'd be a little bit more of a pain in the butt than he was.
What would you do?
I'd just say, you know what? I'm just going to go home. Let you guys can deal with this. I've already dealt with this. Everyone in my life who matters to me has already dealt with it 17 years ago. You guys want to pull this muck up and fling it around for a little while? More power to you. I'll see you. I'm going home.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. One of the other points that was brought up in the State of the Union address, which raised some eyebrows amongst all of the staff, is this idea of school uniforms. And on Capitol Beat, one of the people who was against it, or against the idea, raised it and said, it essentially comes down to being a violation of the First Amendment. It's a First Amendment offense to make someone actually, you know, wear a certain set of clothing. And during the State of the Union, the president says, look, if it means that our students will pay more attention to mathematics and literature and history and blah, 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 then doggone it, let's get them in school uniforms. So I don't think we've ever covered this issue before. So I wanted to ask, what do you think about school uniforms?
Well, my first issue is that having been up against a First Amendment issue, and I think we covered
that. Yes, we did.
As a high school student, the First Amendment does not apply to you when you're under 18. It only applies in limited scope. So it is not a clear-cut legal argument like they try to present it. Because even Ainsley Hayes says, I'm not sure the president has a legal footing to stand on here, or something to that effect.
Constitutional.
And, yeah, it's a bunch of baloney. As far as I have been, had the law explained to me by a lawyer when I was in First Amendment trouble, they can do pretty much whatever they want.
Okay, that was a nice comment. Now would you like to actually answer the question? What do you think about school uniforms?
I support it.
You would be okay with...
I would totally support it.
Okay.
And I think they should be the ugliest, dumbest looking clothes we can find.
Gray, itchy wool?
Yes, absolutely.
So you're really okay with it.
Yeah.
So from kindergarten through high school?
Yeah.
All the way through
all the way
high
through,
school.
All the way through graduation.
I think I'm okay with the idea. I don't think I would be jumping up and down, you know, in favor of it. But that's because in the school I lived in, it was a small rural community, so we didn't have, you know, the extreme numbers. Like, my graduating eighth grade class was 30 people. it was probably, I think, about 25. My high school graduating class was around 100, somewhere between 100 and 150, around there. It's small. So there wasn't a huge, huge disparagement like you get with large internal urban cities where you are just packing tons and tons of people in there, and that you could end up walking away with a bit of a class system.
Yeah, from my time in an urban school system,
yeah, I had 300 in my graduating class, so I'm not much different than you. But it happened in our high school.
I mean, there was a very distinct line that was drawn between the wealthier kids,
sure,
and the poorer kids.
Yeah, you're right. There is.
There was horrible ostracization that happened. Now, I'm not saying you're going to get rid of that. I understand. Kids are still going to ostracize each other.
Yeah,
kids are still going to be
the monsters. You know, the rich kids are still going to come to school in their Corvettes,
unless,
right,
you don't allow them to come to school in cars.
So I think that I'm okay with it, but I don't. If indeed it is something that has been proven that we get better scores, better grades, the children actually are paying more attention because they're in school uniforms, then I would say, you know what, why not put them in uniforms?
Yeah, I don't care what it causes them to do to their grades. I think we should do it anyway.
Yeah. What? Regardless of what it does to their grades, let's put them in uniforms.
Can't you tell,
wow,
that I'm trying to make it clear that high school is prison? We ought to dress them like prison. We ought to treat them like they're in prison. It needs to be clear that it's a prison.
Mandy, do you understand now why I called him a social outcast? Do you understand now?
Why are you addressing her specifically?
Because she and we had this conversation when she dropped by to meet you.
Oh, okay.
And she also commented on the blog about it, where she said, you're not a social outcast. Okay, Mandy, you're wrong on that. He is. Okay, well, we've covered this here. Trek Quest 5 is in favor of school uniforms.
He was like the yard. I mean, I understand what he's saying. I think my problem with what the woman says about school uniforms is that we are guaranteed the right to schooling, but then she says, not if we reject the idea of having it. We have the right to go to school, but if you refuse that right, is that...
That's false.
Okay.
You are required to go to some kind of schooling. It's not a right. It's mandatory.
That's what she said,
yeah,
if I remember. But it's... The way she said it, it seemed like she was saying that you don't have the right to... That it's not a right if you say you have to wear a uniform.
Okay, I don't know what point you're trying to make. But
okay.
Great.
Why was everyone so... Well, you know what? No. Toby answers this question better in The War at Home. But I remember writing down in my notes here, why is everyone against talking about Social Security? It makes up, I think, either a quarter or a third of our national budget. Why aren't we talking more about it?
And it's going to become more and more of our national budget over the next 20 years.
Yeah, why in the world aren't we discussing this?
It's a very simple answer in my mind. Because it's a Ponzi scheme, and everyone at the top knows it's a Ponzi scheme. And the more we talk about it, the more other people start to realize it's a Ponzi scheme. It is an illegal form of taxation that we need to get rid of. And if our generation is the one that has to say, you know what, we will pay into it, but we will not withdraw from it, I think our generation should be the ones to do that.
And just let it sort of die out?
Just get rid of it.
Now, one of the things, when it was first introduced, so this was back in the days of FDR.
Yes.
It was, people said, this really helped to develop the middle class. Whereas before that, there was no middle class. Are we concerned, possibly, that this might help, or this might have a very large detrimental effect upon our society by taking away this, well, it's a safety net, let's just really call it a safety net. Are we creating more of a problem for ourselves by taking away that Social Security?
I think with the education programs that we have in place, with the prevalence of retirement plan options being provided by employers, and with the absolute abundance of access to information for anybody who wants it, including homeless people who can walk into pretty much any public library anywhere in the United States and get on the internet and read, I think that we have resolved most of the concerns that the Social Security program specifically was trying to address, which is that people did not save, people did not know how to save, mm-hmm. people did not consider, you know what, at some point in my life I'm no longer going to be working and I need something to rely on.
Right.
And I really think we've solved that on the whole.
Let me ask you this. What about the worker who is making minimum wage, who doesn't have the extreme skilled labor that would allow him to make money? He's going to get to a point where he probably can get by, but by the end of his life, he's not going to have a quote-unquote nest egg. What are we saying about that segment of society?
What I'm saying is that if we stop taking money away from him as a youth and as a man, middle-aged adult, and give him the option and the opportunity to invest that himself, I think that we're at a point in American culture now where, on the whole, that would be more successful than the government trying to take it as a tax and have each generation pay for the previous one.
So you're saying, you know what? Let the buyer beware. Let him deal with himself. You're taking a very market economist approach to this.
Yeah, free market.
And if he doesn't take care of himself, then what do we as society do with him? When, as the Aesopic fable would say, the grasshopper and the ant. The ant has saved. He saved and saved and saved all through summer. And winter came and he had stores. The grasshopper did not. And now the grasshopper has nothing to eat. What do we do then?
We already have programs in place for all that stuff that don't rely on Social Security money.
What programs are there? I'm not aware
food
of
banks,
any.
Homeless shelters, jails.
Sorry. See?
I went into the Scrooge.
I'm
for
coming
a
back here and saying you're a Scrooge.
I was like listening to myself talk and I just couldn't stop the Scrooge snowball that was I started there. But really, we do have a lot of welfare programs for people that, aren't able to make money. It's not, and I'm not advocating those welfare programs. I'm saying I think we've already solved what you're asking about. Now, is it the right solution? Probably not. But that's a different question than the one you were asking.
Okay. I was more interested in, you and I had a discussion of ideas right now. We came up with a couple of ideas here, albeit probably not the best, a little limited, based upon the fact that we don't have all of the information together. But we still came up with something. Wouldn't it be great if we talked about it more and educated society about, hey, look what's happened. Here's the situation where we're at. We need to find something better along the way.
I do think that it would be great.
Yes. That's why I get frustrated when I hear them. They were planning to talk about Social Security, and at the end, no. Let's announce a Blue Ribbon Committee.
To go talk about.
Yeah.
We're announcing our intention to discuss it at some point.
Yeah, and that frustrates me here and now. Why aren't why aren't our political leaders out there saying, okay, guys, here's the hard and fast look at this, and you know what? It's a problem. We need to address it and address it to the American people as a whole and get them involved in this. I really would like that to happen.
I would like it too. I just don't think you're ever going to see it happen because it's such a slush fund right now for the government to dip into.
Dip into? Dip into what?
They use the Social Security money to pay for other things right now.
You're going to have to cite an example. I'm calling your card on this one.
Go get the movie. I think it's called Maxed Out, I think is the name of the movie. Nope, that's the wrong one. I mentioned it when last time your friend John Madsen was on here. It's a documentary where they actually show over the past 20 years what have we spent Social Security money on, and only 40% of the Social Security money that was in there was spent on Social Security.
Okay, this is going to be your bullet point to add to the blog post for when we post this podcast so that we can have something out there
as your
reference there. Because I don't know. I just think that your view in general is a little on the extreme. And so I'm not willing
because
to
Because I call it a Ponzi scheme?
No. I believe what you're talking about very much, you know, could be identified as a type of pyramid scheme. It can be. I'm not willing to, you know, put blinders on and say it's not.
Okay.
I understand that. But but your extremization of it, I'm not willing to believe just yet that the government is just squandering it all away. I believe it's because we're living longer and there are a lot more people out there who are now drawing on the vast stores.
That is going to be the problem in the future.
I think it's the problem now.
Social Security is not bankrupt yet.
I know it's not bankrupt yet, but we're losing money because so many people are drawing out from it.
We still have more money going in right now than we're taking out.
Yes, that's why we're not bankrupt.
Right.
I get that.
Okay. All right.
Were you frustrated by Abby Bartlett?
A lot in this episode.
I wrote down the note here. Abby Bartlett always seems to have a bug up her butt. Like, that seems to be the only point and reason for which they bring her into an episode. It's just so she can yell at the president
because
about
that's
something.
That's all Stockard Channing knows how to do. come on the screen and be a pain in the rear.
Name the things that Stockard Channing has been in that you've watched besides Grease and West Wing.
Come on.
No, that does not get to be your evidence. This one thing that she's done. That just happens to be the way
I also saw her do this in a Lifetime movie, but I'm hard-pressed to remember which one it was.
Pretty sure it was any of the Lifetime.
I don't know. It just seems incredibly poor. I get where they're eventually going with this. The whole point is, you know, she's saying, look, we had a deal here. This is definitely a husband-wife argument that's going on. But I'm still kind of annoyed that the writing staff just only brings her on to...
That's what they use her for.
To bitch and moan. Sorry, I apologize for my language there. It just seems incredibly short-sighted. Couldn't they use her for something else?
I don't think they can. Well, not with the casting job they've done.
Yeah, they could. Yes, your reasoning aside... I thought that was short-sighted.
I think it's interesting that she was able to detect just from the items he mentioned in his speech. She figured out that Toby and Leo have put Bartlett back up for re-election.
Yeah.
Because I don't think Bartlett himself has made the decision yet.
Some of our comments tonight may refute that.
Okay. So my assertion is the tone and the body language that I got from Martin Sheen in this episode and the next couple episodes is that he doesn't know himself yet if he really is running for a second term. And it's really Toby and Leo who are directing the message and are pitching him for a second term.
Yeah. The last thing I really want to mention here, Ainsley meeting the president, absolutely hilarious.
That was pretty funny.
Wow, what he says to her? Wildly inappropriate.
That's what Sam told him to say.
Well,
I don't think it was inappropriate.
Really?
He said some people have said that that's why you're here.
Did you see the smirk on his face?
Oh.
Did you see what she was wearing? You don't think that someone...
I don't think the words themselves were inappropriate.
I would never say that to any of my personnel. And that should be an indication for you of how inappropriate this is. I'm pretty conservative in the way that I talk to my people, yes, but that's a no-no.
You mean you're pretty liberal?
No, I'm pretty conservative.
So you would stay away from anything that's questionable?
Not always, but yes, for the most part.
Okay.
Still hilarious.
It really was.
Really hilarious. Because apparently she's never met the president, and now, first time she meets him, she's singing...
Blaming it on the bossa nova.
Wearing a bath towel and drinking a
bath
drink.
Bathrobe.
Bathrobe, sorry.
The bath towel. Wow, that scene would become so much more entertaining if all she had was a bath towel.
Okay, I'm done.
Would you cash a check from the first lady or the president?
It depends. If I'm in the situation that the person who had received the check was in, heck yes, I need that money. If I'm a person, it depends on the president. It depends on the person who wrote me the check.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Sure. Okay. Aaron, you got anything?
Sam annoyed me again with his interference with making sure that Ainsley meets with the president.
Okay.
Once again, he's going off on his own to say, I think this is right. I'm going to do it, even though it's a dumb idea and it's going to be an annoyance to everyone.
Okay. Okay.
And yet, it's Ainsley who looks stupid in the end.
Listener comments, then.
Yep.
We've got two emails, and you told me earlier this evening...
We have an audio clip.
We have an audio. Where do you want to stick that in?
Let's do it first.
Do you want to do it first? Okay.
Yeah, so we actually had someone finally take us up on our Google Voice number.
Yes.
I was pretty excited about this. So we have some comments here from Pete's friend, John Madsen. We're just going to go ahead and listen to those right now.
Hello, hi. This is Pete's friend, John Madsen. I'm just calling in to leave my comments for podcast number 62. Well, my hand hurts, so I don't think I'm going to type the comments. So I'm going to try doing this voice thing. But before I say anything, I just have to say... I don't really have that many comments because I'm enjoying watching West Wing so much that it's very tedious to take notes. And also my hand hurts, so I don't want to take notes. But we'll see where this goes. First of all, episode whatever, Bartlett's third State of the Union address, the only thing I can think of is this the episode where Ainsley is dancing around because she did well on that Married with Children guy's news program show where she was a commentator on. I think that's cool because I do like seeing Ainsley dance around in her bathrobe. I think it's pretty fun and, you know, like she could totally pull it off and everything. But I do think it's kind of strange that when she was on the show with Sam and she did far better with Sam when she eviscerated him, she didn't do any dancing at all. She was just business as usual. In this case, she actually kind of made a fool of herself in kind of saying that what the president was doing was not constitutional, for example. And apparently that was awesome. That was why she was dancing around. I don't quite get it. Maybe a theory about this is she's happy that she could, as a conservative, she could get in there and sabotage a liberal president. Or it takes less for her to be happy as a liberal. And she, like several of us, we tend to be conservative when we're young, and yet as we grow a little older, we tend to be slightly more liberal. Of course, it works the other way, too. Maybe that's what's happening with Ainsley. I don't know. Maybe that's what Sorkin's trying to show.
Yes, John. This is the show. This is the episode where she is on the news program with that guy from Married with Children. And yes, she is hot.
You know, I don't know that she didn't dance around after eviscerating Sam. We just don't see it. Because it's well after the program is over before she decides to celebrate.
I could see this being a bigger deal for her because she's, number one, doing this show at the White House right after the State of the Union. And it probably was a bit of a rush.
And she's doing it as a representative of the White House.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
You know, this is her first time that we know of really going out publicly and representing the White House from a legal standpoint.
Yeah. So good comments there, John. And sorry, buddy, we hope your hand gets feeling better. Okay, so the emailed comments. Okay. Who do you want to do first? We've got Mandy, or we've got listener Jim.
Let's go with Mandy.
This is Mandy. This is her first ever comments that she sent into the episode. So, Mandy, thank you very much. You're very kind. She says, I don't have much to write with this email, so I'll cover the meaningless highlights because I know you have already covered the real issues. Plus, I have a sneaky suspicion you won't get to this one either. Okay. Was it just me, or was anyone else confused for a brief second when they called CJ Claudia Jean? Now, I know why her character goes by CJ. It doesn't fit her at all. I also love that she wasn't wearing any pants. Who comes up with this stuff? Also, I loved the no-pants dance Ainsley was doing when she finally met the president. I mean, in college, the no-pants dance meant something entirely different, but this brings a whole new meaning to it. Do either of you know what that means?
No.
Okay.
I
can
make
fair,
some wildly inappropriate guesses.
Yeah, neither of you went to college.
Let's brainstorm on this.
Let's list some possibilities on the whiteboard.
Mandy, you're going to have to tell us what the no pants dance means.
I wonder if it's like a variation of the Walk of Shame.
Oh, maybe. Maybe. I don't know. I'm sort of scared to ask. But Mandy, you should tell us. She continues on. A more literal, blah, blah, blah. And for Bartlett to follow it up with, I never even knew we had a nightclub down here. And a lot of people assumed you were hired because you were, you know, a blonde Republican sex kitten. And, well, they were obviously wrong. Keep up the good work. Loved it. But he kind of did come off as a little bit of a jerk right there. Which brings me to my next point. Which we won't actually get to because she starts going on the next episode. So I think she's going to talk more about President Bartlett.
Okay.
Listener Jim. Listener Jim.
Welcome back, Listener Jim.
Yeah, Jim. Peter and Joey, I'm turning into a zombie. I've not been sleeping well. One of my daughters keeps waking me up. My brain and emotional state are both a little frazzled. I'm almost a little weepy this week watching Ellie. Fortunately, even exhausted, my inherent masculinity quelled any sniffly feelings.
He's but just trying to shame me, isn't he?
I think he may be. But that episode does put a lump in my throat. I hope you're both doing well. Peter, I know you've been terribly busy. Don't work yourself too hard. On to the comments. Bartlett's third State of the Union. A longer storyline has begun here, and we hardly even know it. Abby is angry that Jed has begun thinking towards his re-election, and that anger is one of the things that leads to Toby finding out something is wrong later. This is really good stuff here. But let's get to the really important issue. Josh and Joey, or Josh and Donna? You decide. One of the things I like about Joey is that she is in every way equal to Josh, while Donna is Josh's subordinate. I have had a hard time imagining Josh making a relationship work well with either one of them, though. We'll have to see how he does with Amy next season. Oops, spoiler. I'm just glad we didn't have to endure the actual relationship between him and Mandy. Which, by the way, let's take a brief sidestep here and answer Jim's question. Josh and Joey, or Josh and Donna? Who would you like to see?
Josh and Joey.
Josh and Joey? Why is that?
Well, I think he and Joey would make a great couple.
Joey Lucas.
Yeah, of course. Norman
and Joey Lucas.
That's what I meant. I don't think our listeners can tell anything else.
You don't think Pete's laughing gave anything away, huh?
Oh, for those of you who didn't see, Aaron gestured with his thumb over towards Joey, the recent guest host of Trek Quest 5.
More frightening now that I think about it, because I commented earlier how Pete is like Josh.
We just cannot get away from that joke. Whatever we do, it keeps coming back.
We're done. This podcast is on hiatus. Pull the plug. Oh, holy cow. Aaron, that comment alone may earn you a new nickname other than the intern. Okay, Joey, what about you? What do you think?
Well, I'm going to say...
Who would you like? Not who will work out together. Who would you like to see together?
I'm going to say Josh and Donna, but I'm also going to disagree with...
With yourself?
No, with Jim.
Oh, with Jim.
Just a little bit. Where
okay.
He says that Donna is his subordinate. Well, that's technically true. I think it's clear to me, at least, that Josh cannot function without Donna.
Yes.
She is way too ingrained into what he does on a daily basis. And I think that that is what ultimately makes me want to see them in a relationship together, is because they are, to use a really corny psychologist word, they are interdependent. They have made active choices that have built their lives around each other, not to the sense that it's unhealthy, but to the sense that they actually can be a part of each other's life. I feel like Joey Lucas is too independent, and that would eventually harm their relationship in the long run.
I would disagree. I see some characteristics in Joey that are very much she could work things out, so whatever the differences may be, she would find a way to work them out. And that's why I would like to see Josh and Joey together. I think they definitely make a very good pair mentally. You know, they're both incredibly intelligent, and so...
They make smart babies.
Yeah. Plus,
pretty good-looking babies.
I personally like to think of myself as Josh, and I would love to be able to be married to Marley Matlin. I think she is awesome. Okay, let's move on with Jim's comments here. On an absolutely unrelated note, I can understand why people don't like Ainsley. I do like her myself, but too often she is less character and more caricature. One of Sorkin's weaknesses as a writer is that while he writes clever dialogue, he also tends to write wacky characters. Ainsley sometimes tips too far toward wacky. However, I find her charming. While her fear gets a little over the top in these two episodes, i.e. not noticing she walks into a closet until she wound up in one, her discussion with Sam about representing the president's viewpoint on TV was quite good. The president is likewise charming, but also quite an unpleasant person at times. His treatment of Abby here is none too good. As she points out, they had a deal for one term, because his health is likely to have deteriorated much in a second term. Yeah. You forgot the word term there, Jim.
Way to go.
Thanks for screwing me up. See, that's why I mess up. It's what the people are writing in here. That's why I'm tripping up. But he treats that deal as meaningless. Quote, unquote, that was 3 years ago. But the deal was still valid, right? Maybe he should have talked to his wife before he decided to begin campaigning again. Do you think that he's begun campaigning?
I think
you
I said made it clear that I don't think that Bartlett has made up his mind yet. I think he's being railroaded by Toby and Leo. Hmm. Now, I do think he will eventually come around and support this
And oh, good. You're willing to agree that he might actually be running for a second term.
No, I'm saying, out of the context of the episodes that we have, I think we have enough information to say, in the next few episodes, we will see him start to come around to this idea. But in this particular episode, I don't think he has yet.
We'll have to leave it there. Should we move on to ratings?
Yes. You get to go first, Pete.
I think this is super. I think it's fun. I think it's solid. I give this a 7.
Okay. I'm also going to give it a 7. I really like the State of the Union episodes. You know, they always do something very, very fun in them, or very, you know, dramatic, or at least in the two we've seen so far. I don't remember if
well,
we get to see anymore.
I'll agree with you on everything except for the first one. So I'm only willing to agree with you 50% of the way.
You don't think they did anything dramatic in the first State of the Union episode?
I just don't think it was all that impressive.
Where he passes out and breaks this pitcher and we find out that he's got MS?
Yes, but the whole idea about the speech itself.
No, no, no. I'm saying in the episodes where they have him giving
State
of the Union.
You're saying in general about the episode, everything else going along with it.
I think they do a better job in those episodes than they do in some of the other
stuff. I misunderstood what you were saying there.
I really do like the speech that he gives here. You know, the little pieces of what we give.
Yeah.
I wish they would give us more. I understand it's probably hard to write.
We don't listen to the real State of the Union addresses. And I realize you may, and I know
do.
I do, but okay.
I'm saying they give us little tiny snippets, and they give us those little tiny snippets over and over again, especially when with Abby on Rewind.
Yeah.
They have such good speech writers on the staff of the West Wing. You know, the writing staff for this television show. I would like to see them get to do more of that.
Okay, Aaron?
I gave it a 6.5. I really liked...
We've gone so long without a half rating. No, you're done. You're still the intern.
You just took away all that glory that he'd given you before. You just gave it right back.
I would have given it a 7, but the thing with the DEA agents kind of, I didn't really find it all that interesting, I guess. Compared with the rest, like I felt the it just wasn't as good writing.
Okay.
As the rest of the episode, so it kind of pulled it down a little bit.
Well, it is the B plot.
Moving on to our next episode, The War at Home. Joey, read the summary, please.
President Bartlett is fighting a war on two fronts as he tries to rescue hostages in Colombia and deal with explaining to his wife why he's breaking his word to her by running for a second term.
Okay. This it's keeping on. They're still jabbing and punching away here as far as episodes go. I think this is good, really, really good. I liked it.
Yeah, one of the scenes that we see in this episode that I really like is when Jed is out on the President Bartlett is out on the balcony playing chess against himself. Can't remember if I ever mentioned on the podcast before the experience of playing chess downtown in Salt Lake City.
I think you have mentioned it before. Okay. It's been a long time.
It's just, we have in downtown Salt Lake City, right next to a bookstore, they've constructed some marble chess tables. And they have benches, and you can just go sit there. And so before I had kids, I would sometimes go there late at night, and I would just set up the chess boards, put the timer out, and just wait for people to walk up and play me.
Late at night?
Late at night. Usually 11:30 to 1 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
And I always found people who would come up and play.
Huh.
And some of them were very, very good. I like to think of myself as an okay player. I'm not, you know, winning any tournaments or anything like that, but...
I consider myself very good. The bishop is... That's the one that can go the diagonally way...
Yes,
that's the
bishop. Yeah,
and the horsey guy, he goes the turn right cornery.
The L. Yeah.
I'm okay at chess. I can't bother to get into it that much. It's sort of fun and okay, but to put that much thought into it just is stifling.
I look at it the same way as I look at racquetball. It's something I enjoy doing well enough. I enjoy enough doing that I don't care that I'm not any good at it. You know, and I've hit a cap, and I probably will never be any better at it.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned racquetball. I used to play you in such a way to set you up for a move later on down the line. I couldn't do it in chess the way that other people do. They're like, oh, yeah, I'm setting him up. Six moves from now, I'll get him. Or I'll get this one piece that I really want. I could never... My brain doesn't work in that fashion. But when it came to playing racquetball against you, I was doing certain things to get you in a certain position to beat you, to get the ball past you. Or even in soccer, there are times when I do certain things in order, you know, I'm planning my moves out.
Gotcha.
Essentially. So interesting that I couldn't do it in chess, but in other circumstances I can.
I think it's probably just a lack of familiarity with the game. You play it enough and you could get there.
Possibly. I just wouldn't enjoy it
okay.
that much. I want to talk to you for a second about polling. We saw polling in the last episode. We see it again in this episode. What do you think about polling?
I don't participate.
You don't participate at all.
it's just another form of the census.
Oh, man, you are so screwed up.
I think it's just people going to his house saying, and your credit card number is... Yes, this is part of the census. Just please show me what's in your wallet.
So you don't even like the idea of polling. If people call you...
I generally will not participate.
What if it's a poll about the... What if you were one of the people that these pollsters were calling? Would you take the time to answer the questions?
About the State of the Union?
Yes.
I don't know. It would depend. If I felt really strongly about what had happened either way, I probably would. Just to, you know, vent either excitedness or displeasure.
Right.
There are certain things that I will participate in. I'm part of a group that they call the Contemporary Consumers Panel, that about every 2 or 3 weeks, the television studios email me I guess it's a poll or a survey that is asking me, okay, what shows do you like on television? What ads do you remember seeing? You know, did you follow up on any of those ads? Things like that. Trying to gauge really what should be on television. I don't know that my vote has any authority whatsoever, but I think that a lot of good shows end up canceled and a lot of crap ends up lasting for 20 years. I had something caught in my throat.
Look, pal, the first 5 to 7 years of ER was fantastic.
I'll take your word for that.
Yeah, it were.
Anyway, so I participate in that because I have very strong feelings on the subject. But there's a lot of things in this world that I just don't care about. Okay. And people want me to take a poll or to take a survey or to sign a petition. And I'm like, you know what? Can't get up enough emotion to, like, sit here and even listen to you ask me the questions.
Okay. Aaron, what about you?
I don't particularly like them or dislike them, but... It depends on what it's about. Like, watching TV on the internet, watching Hulu, I will answer the little thing that pops up every once in a while because I enjoy their product. You know, I like to be able to say, hey, you're doing a good job. You know, this is what I like. This is where you could improve. Okay. I think if it were a State of the Union kind of thing, you know, the president, I think, would deserve my answering a few questions.
I think he should deserve your time, yeah.
I think he deserves better than Aaron's time, personally.
Hey, Aaron's got a vote just like everybody else, and you can't take that
Aaron,
away from
the last
him.
Time you voted in an election?
I've never registered.
I think he deserves better than Aaron's time. The guy's not even going to register.
Well, he's trying to stay under the wire.
That's how they track you.
I was thinking about polls, and I think, well, I'm okay with them. But when it comes down to it, much like you, I end up thinking that they're just political telemarketers. Really?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Calling in to pester you.
Josh and Sam have breakfast with the president.
They have 30 seconds with the president, where he orders them eggs.
They sit in the president's private dining room, and as far as I can tell, they get to eat. I liked that scene. I liked the setup of the dining room. I liked the idea of someone coming in and saying, what would you like for breakfast this morning, sir?
That would be awesome. Absolutely awesome. I used to have that.
Oh, really?
Yes. The chef that I had was my mother.
Oh, okay.
I would come, for the most part, for breakfast every morning. She was like, okay, what do you want to have? And sometimes she would choose, and other times it was, here's cold cereal. But a lot of times it was, oh, you know, I'd like some pancakes, or, yeah, I'd like waffles. And she would make it.
Wow.
It was wonderful.
Our mom did not really ever make breakfast.
I realize that not every mother did that. My mother did, and I, at the age that I am now, and I've been around enough people like you who didn't have mothers who did that, I am through the moon, like, so happy that my mom did that for me. Like, I love that she did that.
I really liked it, you know, the whole, I don't know, I just put myself in that scene. I thought, man, that would be sweet. You just go in, you got your own little dining room. The guy comes in and says, what would you like for breakfast this morning? And you say, oh, how about monkey brains? Anyway, that's all I really had to say about it, is I thought that would look like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
What do you think about the war on drugs, Pete?
I don't know. I wrote the war on drugs. What is it for? It seems as though it goes back to our prevention or punishment argument that we had so long ago. I would like to think that we should do more in the prevention area, and that we necessarily shouldn't be just thinking, okay, we need to punish them. But there's more to the war on drugs, as we see in this episode, because of the five DEA agents who had been taken hostage in Colombia. It seems as though that's really where we ought to be considering the quote-unquote war taking place. I think that this episode makes it abundantly clear that, well, and my economic background should make it very clear to me, if we don't have buyers here in America, we don't have a drug problem. It goes away very, very quickly.
Okay, so how do we get rid of the buyers?
Well,
deport them?
I think it comes down again to education. It has to come down to education. You're not going to be able to get everybody, but I think that if you properly educate people about these things, then they're going to be able to make an informed decision. You're never going to take away the people who just want to go out there and have a good time and get high. We will always have those people. They will be doing it with, if it's not cocaine, they will find something else with which to do it.
Okay.
So let's not be stupid and think that we're going to stop the entire problem. But I think that we can stop it a lot better than we currently are.
Instead of seizing the shipments, we could just poison them. Only the users are going to die.
We're going to protect our citizens by killing the citizens.
Just the ones who are users.
I think it was Stephen Wright, the comedian, who said, I'm not saying that I think there should be a death penalty for stupid people. I'm just saying let's take the warning labels off of everything and wait for the problem to take care of itself.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that, you know, we as society have, or I should say the government has a responsibility here that they should be trying to do something about this. What we're currently doing, I don't know. I don't know hardly anything about what our current plans in the war on drugs are. But I think that we could be doing more as far as education goes. Okay. As an example, the smoking campaigns that the Truth organization, you know, what they're doing. I think we need to have a whole lot more of that.
Okay. You think those are being effective?
I think they are, yes.
Okay. They're certainly entertaining.
Well, yeah, yeah.
I think they make some good ads.
Yeah. So we clearly have the husband and wife argument. And I want to just say, if you're one of the assistants who's in the room helping her pack,
awkward.
Oh my gosh, how could you walk back into the room when the president leaves? Because you know that the wife is going to be pissed as all get out from what transpired, because they can hear through the door.
Yeah, you know they're out there drawing straws to see which one has to go in first.
So it's clear I've never had a husband and wife argument. Joey, I know we've discussed this before, and so I don't necessarily want to rehash and say, okay, tell us the latest argument that you had with your wife, because I don't want to get you in trouble.
I appreciate that.
Not necessarily get you in trouble. But how... Let me ask it in this way. The arguments are going to happen. How do you diffuse them from turning into just a shouting match back and forth?
Well, I know it really makes my wife angry that this is my response to your question, but I disengage. I walk away. I will, in the middle of a sentence, it doesn't matter if it's my sentence or her sentence, when I realize there is no way this ends in anything other than a fight, I will turn around and walk away.
Okay, well, it's clear that this is not going to be of use, so those of you out there who are listening, who have, had a husband or wife, and you've had an argument.
Absolutely. If you have the answer, please publish it.
Yeah. Well, let's hear.
I'm sure you could make a lot of money, in fact.
How can you, number one, avoid the fight in the first place? And number two, how can you help prevent it from getting into just a screaming match?
I can say if you can manage to keep your mouth shut, you'll probably avoid most of the fights. Unfortunately, that is not a skill I have acquired in my life.
I'd like to tackle the first question I just posed there, which was, how do you stop it from happening in the first place? I think a lot of it comes down to honesty and avoiding selfishness in your relationship.
I don't know, man.
I think a lot of it is going to come down to bending your will to the will of the relationship and not just to your own.
Okay, but there are going to be instances where it's important.
Where you disagree and you have to argue through
you
your
have
point.
To argue through it.
Yeah, I would agree.
Anything to do with raising your children, mm-hmm. there's going to be a fight about it because you're going to have differing viewpoints on certain things, and it's my kid. I'm not going to let that go easily.
So you can have a debate without having an argument, though. I think there's a difference.
The problem is that
you and I debate a lot.
Yes,
we walk away from it, and I'm going to go ahead and say, for probably 90% to 5% of our debates, they haven't been arguments. Neither one of us walked away and said, "I hate that dirty, rotten so-and-so."
It didn't degenerate
down into that sort of thing.
I think a big part of the difference is the male-female part of the equation. I think that the way that men communicate and the way that women communicate is so very different that when you start to have what you would like to call a debate, that just there's that communication gap that I don't know anyone who's managed to cross it successfully, and it's almost always going to be something you're deeply emotionally engaged in. So it's not like something that you can just say, yeah, okay, that's the end of the topic, which we do a lot. You know, we say, okay, I think we've talked it out. Obviously, neither one of us is going to budge. Let's move on. When I have an argument with my wife, it's never something that I feel like I can just say, yeah, we're never going to agree on this one, let's just walk away from it. Because if it were something like that, it would never have escalated to the point of an argument in the first place. I'd say, okay, yeah, you know what, if that's the way you want to do things, that's fine with me. I'll support you in that.
You know what, you're wrong, and I can't even talk to you when you get in this situation. So you know what, let's just move on. Let's just get away from this. I can't even talk to you when you're like this.
Do you understand the point I'm trying to make, though?
I do. I do, absolutely.
I think a lot of it is just so much of a difference in the way men and women communicate. And even though I know that intellectually, and I've read numerous like marriage counseling books and things like that, not that my wife and I are in trouble, but, you know, even before I got married, I wanted to have a successful marriage, so I tried to study this. And knowing that intellectually, but actually applying it when you're having a heated debate about something and you're saying something and you don't feel like you're being heard, and they're saying something and they don't feel like they're being heard, it escalates very, very rapidly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Good stuff. Let's move on here. The last thing that of meat that I really wanted to discuss is the whole DEA agents, the Colombian drug lord. You know, do we let Aguilar out of the prison? You know, and what do we do in this situation? The United States got caught with their pants down. Really, is what it turns out.
We never anticipated the possibility that somebody might try this. We weren't prepared for someone to try and outfox this with a stratagem so sophisticated that it's an entire generation behind, hey, look, your shoes are untied. Is that how I just lost 9 guys to a damn street gang with a ham radio? So brilliant. So, so brilliant.
The way I know we're laughing about this, but it, the force the that he's saying with it, was awesome.
When he walks out and he's cussing and he's like jerking his arms around, it's so visceral. Brilliant, brilliant acting job here.
Yeah. And he can no longer even maintain the Bartlett voice.
Yeah, yeah, his voice cracks and he's like kind of croaking almost.
Yeah, yeah. That was super. So, what do we do? Do we ask the Columbia? do we let Aguilar out? You know, the argument here is, as we've always said, you know, we don't negotiate with terrorists. You know, we just don't do that. We don't give in to what their demands. Because when you do, then everybody's going to start doing that. Even though we give in to them all the time, at least within the context of these shows. And could we just say, you know what? I'm sorry, DEA agents. We're not gonna go back and rescue you.
I could do that.
If you're one of the 5 DEA agents.
No, if I'm the president,
you could.
I can say, you know what, they served their country brilliantly. We will award them all the awards we can posthumously. We are not sending more people after them. We are not freeing this terrorist. But
political repercussions be danged.
But I also don't. I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but I don't understand the answer to Bartlett's question. In fact, I don't really feel it was answered. Of why don't I just assassinate this guy?
Yeah.
Why don't I send a CIA agent into this prison and knock him off? Why is that not an acceptable answer?
Well, that's what he talks about doing.
Yeah, but as far as I have never heard what I consider a satisfactory response.
Lately,
to that
doesn't
question.
Really answer.
You know, I one of my ideas was, sure, let him out. And then when he gets out, hit him hard. You know what?
Carpet bomb Columbia.
Well, I would. I mean him specifically.
Oh, okay, okay.
You know, if it's true that he's...
Just to be clear, I have nothing against the Colombians. I just like the idea of carpet bombing places in general. There was one other thing I really like in here. When Joey Lucas and Josh are talking... And Josh is saying, you know what, these people, they've told us through the polling, we should not pursue this anti-gun bill, and so we're not going to pursue it. And Joey Lucas says, no, I think you should pursue it more. And she gives this awesome example of, I think she said it was a French royalty or something like that, who said, there go my people. I must find out where they're going so I can lead them. And I think in a lot of ways, we are in that. We are stuck in that mode of government in the United States of America today. And as much as I disagree with a lot of things that the liberals are doing, or, you know, that the message that I hear and things like that, I honestly wish somebody would just step up and say, you know what? this is the path we're going to go down. We're going to get some stuff done. You know, I joked earlier about, you know, maybe doing nothing is actually the better solution. Coming full circle to that topic, I'm saying I understand that that's not the case. I think we're in a situation where it's too much the case already. We need somebody who's just going to stand up and lead and get stuff done. Even if it's the wrong stuff, if we can break this cycle, then we can start to vote in the right people and get the right stuff done anyway.
Just like what we have going on right now. So what I kind of hear you saying is you applaud what it is that President Obama and the current people who are in leadership are doing right now.
I disagree with the choices they made, but I respect the actions that they are taking.
Okay, yeah, I think that's a fair statement.
I felt that the other president offering to release Aguilar seemed kind of a writing cop-out so that he didn't have to make a difficult choice.
I don't know, man. I disagree. I think that was very powerful writing. For that president to say, I respect so much you as a president, and I'm so unhappy with the scenario that's going on here and things like that, that I'm just going to abdicate to your... I think you're smarter than I am. I'm going to let you decide what we do.
Okay.
I would have liked to have seen what Bartlett would do if he didn't have that choice.
Okay. I wouldn't disagree with that, but I wouldn't call it a writing cop-out. Okay. That's going too far. We have listener comments?
Yes, we do. So, continuing on with Mandy when she says... My next point. I love that Mrs. Bartlett calls the president a jackass. Do I think spouses should speak to each other that way? Absolutely not. But honestly, I really felt a ting of satisfaction when she did. For a guy who is rude to Ainsley and can't enter a room without everyone standing and always gets his way, I love that his wife is there to put a little dose of reality back into his life. Things aren't perfect. You don't always get it your way, and you can't always be in control. He wants to deal with her as if something he can check off of his to-do list so that he can focus on his day, something I greatly identify with. But she wants him to give her more time than he is willing. Mrs. Bartlett responds with, "You have a crisis. You have to deal with it. When it's done, we'll talk." Fully taking control of the situation. President Bartlett, knowing he isn't going to win this round, walks away saying, "I feel better already." Love it. I think she deserves his full attention, and she put her foot down. Go, Mrs. Bartlett. So, this is Mandy's take on that. I like the fact that she... Well, the president's family in general. I think I've mentioned this before. I like the fact that they get to cut through all of the... You know, the hype and pomp and circumstance, and you know, they see the guy, you know, when he's been in his sweatpants kind of thing. It's like, you know, you're not that special. And you know what, I get to talk to you this way. In here in this room right now, you're Jed or your dad. And you know what? I don't want to deal with you. I'm gonna walk away. You can't do anything about it. You know?
Not when you're in this mood.
Yeah. Great comments there, Mandy. Okay, listener Jim. He says, nice title, The War at Home. Jed wants to settle things with Abby, but she'll have none of it. He snots at her, "I feel better already." Why should she make him feel better? He's betraying her, and now he wants to be comforted. For her part, Abby does well supporting him. She knows he can't really talk right now, so she puts the conversation on hold. Not an easy thing to do when you're angry. It's not her job to assuage his conscience. I admire her here. Him, I want to tell off. He tries to pretend that he wasn't campaigning. I wouldn't do that without talking to you. But in his anger, admits that he was. Quote, "That's what we do. We run for things." The error in political philosophy notwithstanding, he has no moral high ground from which to express his anger. And all this shows how dangerous his ego is. He deems himself so important that he can justify lying to his wife, the American people, and whoever else besides, so that he will become and remain president. moving on, would you guys release the prisoner to get your men back? I think we just covered that one there. So I hope we answered appropriately for you, Jim. All right. Should we hear my friend John Madsen?
Yeah.
Episode 14, The War at Home. This episode is sort of horrifying because this is the one where they allude that that Josh and Donna like each other. And I really like Josh. I really don't like Donna, so that's kind of sad. But I did think it's kind of interesting that in this day and age, misdirection and miscommunication is used a lot more often than actual communication. And that's what Donna uses with Josh in this case, that she misdirects him because she doesn't actually want him to see the truth.
Yeah, you only get 2.5 minutes, John.
So we lost the end of John's comments there. But it's good to know that John is still staying consistent there with his hatred of Donna. good. Okay.
He makes a great point that misdirection and miscommunication are the way we communicate now. I mean, and a great example of this is the prevalence of sarcasm in our communication today, where really we're saying one thing, but we mean another. And, you know, it is a good point that he makes, that this is something that has really happened to our society in the past 20 to 30 years.
Oh, really?
That's too subtle. I don't think our listeners are going to understand the point you were trying to make there.
All right, let's move on to ratings. Joey, you are up.
I did not like this one quite as much as the last one. I'm going to give it a 6. But there's not really anything I can put my finger on to say what was wrong with it. Just so much as I just didn't walk away from it having enjoyed the episode quite as much.
Yeah, sorry. 5.5. And also, I don't think it was as good as the first part of this.
Okay. I was vacillating between a 7 and or an 8. I'm going to eventually say a 7. I think that this is still good. We get such stark contrast here. As an example, we have the president meeting Ainsley for the second time. And she's so nervous that she says to Leo, I may pee on your carpet. And he looks down and says, you know, your skirt is on backwards.
Yeah.
And she says, okay, can I go to the bathroom now? And he's like, okay. And she walks into the closet. Which, by the way, I think that I've walked into a couple of places sometimes where I'm like, I get there and I'm like, wait, what am I doing in here? This is not at all where I wanted to go. Like, I got tunnel vision and I just walked. I think that could happen.
Yeah, I agree.
Easily.
I've done it, you know, there's 8 buildings on my employer's campus, and there have been times where I've walked into the wrong building, gone down an aisle, expecting to find my desk, and then realized, I don't even know where I am. I've never been in this part of our campus before.
it's funny. The president says the line, I can't smoke in the White House, but she can pee in Leo's closet. Man. And then immediately after that, they go into the deaths of the other players. And the switch there, I think that's true to life. Like, that's something that really happens. There's no, like, in a second, it can go from goofy and funny to unbelievably serious. And I like the way that they handled this. The arguments between Abby and the president, I think that they nailed spot on. As much as I gave them a hard time about how they only just bring on
Abby for
arguments, okay, fine. But this was a decent argument. I think they nailed it. I think they did exactly what would have happened in a real situation.
Okay.
So I give this a 7. I think it's worth it.
Okay.
Moving on to our next episode, Ellie. Joey, would you read the summary to us right now?
The Surgeon General makes some controversial comments about marijuana, leading to an attack by family values groups and an unsolicited comment by Bartlett's middle daughter, Ellie, to Danny Kincannon, that her father wouldn't fire the Surgeon General.
I don't care for this episode so much.
Interesting. And that's why you told John he would hate it?
I don't recall such a comment.
Oh.
Having ever been heard before. Joey's just jumping ahead of...
I am jumping ahead. I think our listeners will forgive it just this once for, you know, the 20-minute conversation.
It's probably fueled from the fact that I don't enjoy this as much.
Interesting.
Possible. I just don't...
So you poisoned him before he ever got a chance to...
Well, he was up and down from that. There was some other guy who was there, and so... You know, he wasn't exactly focusing on it the whole time. I'm pretty sure he fell asleep a couple of times, maybe. And if that's the case, then I mean, it should just speak to the fact that, you know, it's kind of a boring episode. The whole storyline with the Surgeon General, it just doesn't move me that much. So a political appointee got mouthy and political about a topic that she kind of oversees. Okay, I don't see the big deal there.
So, I asked earlier how you felt about the war on drugs, and you're saying that you think we could do more through prevention. So, one of the drugs that's
currently... Education.
I'm sorry, education. Prevention through education, right?
Yeah.
One of the drugs that's illegal that, you know, we talk about is marijuana. Do you think marijuana should be illegal?
Yes. Yes, probably, because I don't see... It's the same reason I believe that... wow, I'm floundering here.
Alcohol?
Horribly. I just don't see the benefit that you gain from it outside of recreation.
Okay.
I don't see... I wouldn't go so far as to say what people said in the 60s and 70s that marijuana is a gateway drug. This idea that you get started on marijuana, eventually you're going to be on PCP and heroin, and it's just going to be, you know, really, really bad. I don't know that I necessarily subscribe to that idea.
Okay.
But I don't know what value it brings to you. Can it be used by medical personnel? Absolutely. I would trust medical personnel to be able to... administer it to any one of their patients that they deemed it appropriate for. So the medical use of it, I have no problems whatsoever. The recreational use of it, no. I'm sorry. I just don't see that.
So should we outlaw...
But then again, I want to say, I think that we should make it illegal for... people smoke tobacco. Okay. And I probably would even go so far as to say certain alcohols.
Okay. Thanks for cutting my question off before I got out.
Okay, you're welcome.
I have a tough time with this one because I'm not concerned about marijuana being a gateway drug to the person taking it.
Okay.
I'm more concerned about marijuana being a method of financing other drug empires.
Explain.
So, a drug cartel wants to run, if we legalize marijuana, a drug cartel wants to finance their cocaine empire, they can run marijuana. And they could, you know, they can do things to the marijuana. You know, I don't know how much you know about marijuana, but there are a lot of things you can do to marijuana to make it more potent or to make it give different effects. There are some of those things that they can do that would allow them to monopolize, in my opinion, any kind of free market attempt at legalizing marijuana.
Sure, okay.
And it becomes a fundraiser for more serious drug activity.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I can see that. I could see if we were to decriminalize it that it would move into an area where the government would then begin to oversee it, much like they do the Food and Drug Administration and such. I could see that there would be, laws regarding how it gets produced and manufactured and distributed.
Right.
And, you know, you can't take it in certain amounts of doses. As an example, Sudafed. You know, you can only buy so much of it
at a time
before they're going to say, okay, why do you want this so bad?
You want to know something else that is light controlled in that same way? Blew my mind last week to find out that this is a controlled substance now. Compressed air.
Oh, sure.
To vacate dust from your computer.
Sure, I can believe that.
It wasn't that I couldn't believe it, but it was just surprising that when I went into an Office Max and tried to buy 6 cans of compressed air so that I would not have to step foot in an Office Max again for another 20 years, that
Wait, 6 cans last you 20 years?
I don't know. I wasn't really doing the math. I was just putting some numbers up.
I would have liked you to have done the math on that and had it actually be 20 years.
I'll bet it'll last me 5.
Okay.
Anyway, they took my contact information and made me show a driver's license.
But they still allowed you to purchase it.
They still allowed me to purchase it. But they said, this is, you know, we need to know who you are. We need to enter you into our computer in a special way so that if you go down the street to another office supply store, it will actually flag you as trying to huff compressed air.
Sure.
Not sure what kind of high that would give you. It's just air.
I don't know. I think that there's something possibly more in it.
Could be.
But I would definitely see. I mean, it's an aerosol can. It's got compressed air. I believe it could be somewhat explosive if used in certain ways.
No, their concern was huffing. They told me. They said the problem is that people huff it.
Sure, and I'm willing to agree to that.
And he actually showed me on the bottle where it says, do not spray this into a rag and breathe it in or something like that. And then it said right underneath that, we have added a bitterant to this in order to discourage this behavior. Like, it's so prevalent that they've actually changed the chemical compound and labeled it, saying, stupid, we made it suck. Please stop doing it. And when I'm using these cans of air that I bought now, like, the whole house starts to smell and taste of this bitterant substance that they added. It's basically grapefruit. I mean, it's like grapefruit oil or something. Very, very bitter, sharp taste. Anyway, just something that I thought I'd throw out there.
Okay.
What do you think about time zones, man?
Time zones? I am okay with time zones.
Isn't that just the weirdest thing?
I think that it's fair to indicate that it is not the same time here where we're at.
Have we talked about this before on the podcast?
I don't think so. Okay. I don't think we have.
Okay.
But I don't know. I just don't think that there's...
Why isn't it the same time everywhere?
How can it possibly be the same time?
Well, if you get rid of, like, AM and PM, go to military time or something, then it's just, you know, 0600 everywhere.
I'm saying it's the same moment for everyone, that moment. Why give it a different label depending on where you're physically located? It's all the same moment. Why can't it all just be one big time zone?
Okay. So, I'm not sure how you would like me to respond to this.
Do you have an answer?
I don't care.
Oh, okay.
I don't see what the big deal is.
I just, you know, I have a hard time with time zones. I really have a hard time remembering how it works. A lot of trouble with how it works. For example, I can never remember when I'm driving from St. George to Las Vegas, do I add an hour or do I take an hour away? I don't know. So am I going to get there on time? Who knows? I can't ever figure it out. I have to call someone and ask them, hey,
it's 1 hour less. So when you're going from Utah into California, if it's 7 o'clock in Utah, it is 6 o'clock in Nevada. Because that's where the magic line is.
I love the conversation that they have around the president's flight. You know, where he's going to cross the international dateline. And he's going to land in D.C. an hour before he took off in Japan.
That is pretty funny.
And Josh's comment, the guy's going for like 150 hours. How could it be Thursday the whole time?
Yeah, that was a really, really funny scene.
You know, I wanted to talk a little bit about the role of the Surgeon General. I didn't know that much about it.
Neither do I. I don't know a ton about it.
So I started to do a little bit of research here for the podcast. I did not know that the Surgeon General is the head of a branch of the military. It's the Public Health Service Commissioned Corps. And she has the rank of a 3-star Vice Admiral. They wear the same uniforms as the Navy does, and they have all the same ranking and stuff as the Navy does. They are generally considered non-combat personnel, unless the president actually orders them to go into combat. And it's this literally this branch of the military that their job is to be doctors. Like, there's military service for doctors. If you go look on the Wikipedia article on the Surgeon General and follow the link to the United States Public Health Service Commissioned Corps, there is a lot of fascinating information in here. I'm not going to try and fit it all into the podcast, but I did not realize all the power and authority that she really does have.
I knew that she was somehow affiliated with the military because all of the Surgeon Generals that I've ever seen, Surgeons General that I've ever seen, were all wearing military uniforms.
And see, I don't think I've ever seen a Surgeon General outside of the West Wing TV show.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
What about C. Everett Koop? Don't you remember that guy?
No.
He was awesome with that beard he had.
So now I have seen Vice Admiral Regina Benjamin, who apparently is our current Surgeon General.
What I think it would be interesting is, what if, I mean, they wear the
uniform?
Uniform, thank you, of someone in the Navy. What if you were an Army person who got appointed to be the Surgeon General? Would you wear your Army uniform? That would be interesting.
That would be interesting.
There has to be a rule about that somewhere. Like, it has to exist.
Yeah,
I'm sure. Just curious what it would be.
I'm sorry, I'm just looking here on the Wikipedia article, looking for C. Everett Koop to see if I recognize him. There he is, right there.
He was around when we were in probably like 7th, 8th grade.
Ronald Reagan, 1989.
Yeah.
82 to 89.
He was awesome. I like that guy.
I'm pretty confident I've never seen that man before in my life. I would remember that look.
He is rocking the beard, though.
He is, isn't he?
I would remember that guy. Never seen him before.
That's why I do remember him, is because of that beard.
It's not just the beard. I mean, he's rocking a sly wink facial expression. <right there. laughs> Anyway, it was something that, until we went to talk about this on the podcast, I never really stopped to think about, yeah, what does the Surgeon General do? Apparently they really do quite a bit of stuff.
And really what happens here is she is doing a talk show or an internet show and says some things about marijuana and
reverses the White House's position on it.
Yeah, makes some comments that the White House is not happy about at all. They want her to step down. She refuses and says, the president will have to fire me. And that gets Ellie involved, who is one of the president's other daughters. And she contacts Danny Kincannon and says, my dad would never fire the Surgeon General. He wouldn't do that. And now the president's in a hard spot. Does he get rid of the Surgeon General for disobeying or, going off on her own political tangent? Or does he not and look like he just did it because his daughter wanted him to? And so that's the other line of the story, is the president and Ellie. He doesn't seem to have a very strong relationship with Ellie. The other two kids, he had them, they were his kids. But Ellie never really seemed to be that way. And so there's a rift between, father and daughter.
I can see why this might have caused Jim some emotional response of some kind, even if it wasn't apparently as girly as what I did last week. Good for you, Jim. I have a hard time talking to my daughter. I mean, she's only 5. But recently, I think I shared this with you, Peter, where I am. She came home from school and informed us that a boy at school had told her he was in love with her. And one of her classmates told her, oh, that means you guys have to be boyfriend and girlfriend now. And she wanted to know, do I really have to be his girlfriend? And she was kind of embarrassed about the whole situation, which I promoted.
Oh, no!
I encouraged.
No, you idiot!
Oh. Not talking to me about it. I didn't encourage her being embarrassed about that, but about being embarrassed about guys telling her they love her.
No, you are so totally wrong about that.
I didn't really do that. But we, you know, we talked about it. And then, like, 2 days later, they had dads and donuts at the school. And so at school, I asked her, all right, which little boy was it that told you he loved you?
Oh, man.
Did you go have the I don't mind going back to jail discussion with him?
No, I was pretty sure it wouldn't sink through on this guy. He didn't look too bright.
Oh, man.
Anyway, I can appreciate this concern of talking to your daughter. Again, you know, I mentioned earlier about men and women communicate so differently, and it's even worse, at least for me, and I think for a lot of dads, when it's that precious little girl that you want to protect and you want to shelter, but you also know that at some point she has to learn how to deal with the world on her own terms and things like that. Such a tough balance. And I can appreciate what President Bartlett's going through here.
Well, it doesn't seem as though they have a strong relationship one with another. I mean, there's definite conflict. And it, you know, that's what happens with some parents. I know in my family that certain children get along with one parent more than the other. It's the truth that it's happened in your guys' family dynamic as well. And so the president is aware of it and doesn't like it and wants to know why.
I like that he asks the Surgeon General, whom he's ostensibly about to fire, how do I get through to my daughter?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear they're, you know, family friends.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, she's the godmother.
Right, exactly. Anyway, that's the end of this episode as far as I'm concerned. I have nothing more to talk about.
I thought there was a couple other things in here. There's an awesome Margaret scene.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
She asked the Surgeon General, she says, you know, they found that this causes cancer in white rats, this causes cancer in white rats, this causes cancer in white rats. Has anyone considered that maybe white rats are just prone to getting cancer? Being a white rat maybe just causes cancer. And there are two lines in this movie that I think express a lot about what just frustrates the heck out of me about our governmental system. The first one is when Leo is talking to the Surgeon General, and he says, I'd like to do the right thing all the time, but I can't. So even Leo acknowledges that he can't do what he believes to be the right thing in this scenario. He has to do the politically expedient thing. And then the other one is when Toby is talking to Andy about the Blue Ribbon Commission. They want this particular guy on the commission. And she asks him, why does this have to be done in secret? And Toby's response is, if you don't do it in secret, it won't get done. He says, you can't solve Social Security and ask them to run for re-election at the same time. We need to get these people in a room, not directly quoting now, but he says, we need to get these people in a room, and they come out and with one voice communicate to the American people without anyone knowing who came down on what side.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating to me that, I don't know if it's true, but if it's true, it's even more frustrating. This perception that we can't trust the American people to believe that we were doing the right thing.
I
don't know how you fix it. I'm just saying, it's one of the things that just drives me crazy about our current system.
Okay.
I really liked the little scene that they have at the end where the president declines the Surgeon General's resignation.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a nice little moment to have there.
Okay. Listener comments here. Mandy only sent in a couple because she didn't have that much time to send in more. So we'll move on to listener Jim. He says, the Surgeon General claims she wasn't commenting on medicine, she was commenting on medicine, but not the law. Do either of you buy that? No.
No. She's absolutely commenting on the law. It's absolutely clear that she is. He continues, her flippancy regarding marijuana suggested from the start that she didn't take the law seriously. And then when asked about the law, she calls it bizarre. Now, she may be right, but doesn't this count as commenting on the law? It seems like it does to me. Her points are probably valid, but that doesn't mean that they were strictly medical. This episode is the first appearance of the rubber ball. I always wait for the ball to make an appearance, knowing how well it will set the tone later, at the end of the Stackhouse filibuster and the beginning of 17 People. What do the two of you make of Griffith refusing to resign? Would you possibly make a boss fire you rather than resign?
I don't think so. I think if it's that clear that I'm unwanted, that I'd rather just leave and move on with my life.
Yeah, it kind of seems as though if you're offered a resignation, there's a reason why. Like, it could be embarrassing for you. Yeah. I don't know. I've never really been in a situation where it was resign or get fired.
I have.
Yeah.
And I resigned.
Yeah. Okay. My friend John Madsen.
I watched this episode with Pete, and I was also busy doing other things, so maybe the answer to this is not so obvious to me. But before the episode started, Pete said to me, you're not going to like this episode. And so as my comment, I just want to ask Pete to answer the question, why didn't I like this episode? Because I'm curious, because I'm not sure exactly why. Maybe Pete knows me better than I know myself, but then again, I didn't pay full attention to the episode, so I'm curious to know. Of course, interesting, the legalization of marijuana is quite interesting. Of course, I've thought about it. One thing I would suggest, maybe we should go a year where marijuana is legal, but during that same year, alcohol is illegal. And we compare the two, we see which one we like better, and we go with that one. How about that?
That sounds like a brilliant idea to me.
You know, I really like, he called and left this on Google Voice, and they do a voice transcription. I shared this with you guys earlier, but I really enjoyed the transcription of the suggestion. One thing I would suggest is that maybe we go a year where Juan Romero is legal, but during the same year, alcohol is illegal, and we compare the two. Didn't realize Juan Romero had been outlawed.
Oh, man, that's too funny. Okay, Aaron.
Ratings. Yes, I gave this a 6. I enjoyed it, but there wasn't really any issue brought up that I really cared about. So just a nice little watch it flick.
Okay. I also give this a 6. I just don't think it's really that great. It's still good, and I like what they're doing with the rest of the story arc in general. I really enjoy that. I just want to make a point. The president comes in and he's talking with Ellie at the end. They're watching the movie, which they have a theater in the White House?
Yes, they do.
Wow.
And a bowling alley.
That'd be awesome. So awesome. But actually, bowling alley, I knew about.
Oh, okay.
Knew about that one. Anyway, he comes in and starts trying to chat with Ellie, and she's like, shh, Dad, people are watching the movie. He's like, what do you want to bet your entire, college tuition that no one in here is going to shush me? I just made the point, I hate people who talk in movies and generally in television shows. If you want to do that, wait until it's over.
Or pause it.
Take some notes, maybe, and we'll talk about it after.
Maybe we can start a podcast.
Maybe. But don't talk during the stinking thing. Okay, I'm done.
Thought I was going to burp there for a second. Yeah, okay.
What if it's really bad? Like a bad movie? Don't you ever talk during a bad movie?
Okay, but only if you go in with that criteria that you're both going, or the people watching are going to be commenting.
So everyone watching the movie has to agree.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I once watched Monty Python and the Holy Grail, a midnight showing of that, with that understanding that it was, it was everyone in the theater delivering the lines at the same time as the characters up on the screen. It was a lot funnier to watch it that way than any of the other subsequent watchings. I mean, the first watching is hilarious, or at least was for me. Subsequent watchings, not so much, but that one was quite funny. As for a rating on this episode, I'm going to give it a 7. I really liked the introduction of Ellie and the dynamic between him and her. I should say between President Bartlett and Ellie. I got a lot of enjoyment out of the scene at the end where he's trying to make up with Ellie. And he starts to try to guess what her specialty is going to be.
Nah.
I got enjoyment out of this because this is a game I play with my daughter around the Disney princesses. When she has a princess, she's huge on the Disney princesses. And whenever she's playing with one of them, I say, "Oh," and I'll intentionally say the wrong princess. "Oh, that's Ariel." "No, Dad, it's Cinderella." No. "Cinderella is the one that had 7 dwarfs and ate an apple." She's like, "No, Dad, that's Snow White." I say, no. "Snow White's the one that met the Beast and had the talking dishware and stuff like that." And so I could really connect with that because it's like she pretends to be frustrated by it, but I know the minute I stop, she's prodding me and trying to get me to play this game with her some more.
Okay, that works with your 5-year-old, not your 25-year-old.
I guarantee you, in 20 years, I will still be trying to play this game with my daughter.
Yeah, it was forced, and it was stupid, and I didn't care for it. Moving on to our next episode, somebody going to emergency, somebody going to jail. Joey would read the summary.
During this year's Big Block of Cheese Day, a college friend of Donna's asks Sam to help get her late grandfather, accused of being a communist spy inside the U.S. government, a presidential pardon. Dealing with the recent revelation that his father had been having an affair for the past 27 years, Sam faces off with an FBI agent and later with Nancy McNally over the pardon. Elsewhere, a group of cartographers completely re-educate CJ on her perception of the globe, and one-time protester Toby, with the help of a straight-talking female security guard, speaks for the White House at a rally to protest against the U.S. participation in the World Trade Organization and various free trade agreements.
Okay, this was fun for me. I really enjoyed this show. Out of all of these that we watched, this is the one I liked the most.
I always loved the Big Block of Cheese Day.
Yeah.
Definitely a good one.
The Peter's projection is awesome.
Peter's one is the one that we're currently using.
No, the Mercator one is the one we're currently using. We use the Mercator projection.
Peter's is the one that we're using. No. Mercator is the one that's... It's different.
You're absolutely wrong, my friend.
Nope, I'm not.
Would you like me to pull up Wikipedia and prove you wrong?
You want to pull up the episode itself?
I will pull up the actual script from the episode. Plain and simple, we'd like the Bartlett administration... I'm sorry. Plain and simple, we'd like President Bartlett to aggressively support legislation that would make it mandatory for every public school in America to teach geography using the Peters projection map instead of the traditional Mercator.
Okay.
Okay.
So the map difference is such that it changes the way the size of the...
bodies of land.
Continents are shaped such that the actual size are shown versus the way that we see it on our current map, which shows the longitude and latitude with straight, even lines to show everything in an exact spot. It exaggerates the size of certain areas.
Mostly the northern hemisphere.
Right. And I love watching this entire scene with CJ as they start doing these things, and they eventually get to the point of flipping it upside down and say, well, what if we make, you know, everything that's in the northern hemisphere in the southern hemisphere?
The bottom.
And CJ says, what are you doing here? You can't do that. And he says, why not? Because you're freaking me out.
It is an awesome scene.
It is. I think everybody should really think about that for a second. We have this idea that the northern hemisphere is on top, and that is the way that we are literally structured, etc., you know, whatever. For us to think about, just for a minute, the idea that everything is, you know, we're the ones that are actually upside down and at the bottom, literally makes me freak out a little bit too. And I don't know if that's just because of the fact that I've always been under this assumption that, you know, Northern Hemisphere, we're at the top, and this is just the way that the world is shaped. I literally have no idea, like, galaxy-wise, how we are positioned. Like, are we upside down? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
It blew my mind. And I wouldn't mind us switching to that kind of a mapping system at all. I think I would be totally okay with it.
So I went and did some research on the Peters projection and different map projections. And I found out that most of the cartographical societies of the world have been pressuring schools and governments and other bodies to stop using rectangular maps entirely. So there's just no accurate way to represent the world on a rectangular map. Use these, you know, they have different kinds of projections that are more elliptical, that allow for a more accurate representation of what the world really looks like.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I would love to see that. The Peters projection is kind of cool to see, just to actually see everything scaled appropriately.
Yeah.
But there are some additional problems that come in with the idea of accepting the Peters projection. One of them being part of the Peters projection is that it actually moves the zero time date line from Greenwich, England, to somewhere in like Turkey or Greece or something like that.
Mm.
Somewhere in the Mediterranean. Oh, I want to say the line ends up running right through the middle of Athens, if I remember correctly. And I think I already made it clear that I have nothing but confusion regarding date and time zones, and I don't want to see that compounded any further.
Well, I'm okay with it being in Greenwich, just because it seems to be right in the middle of nowhere. You know, just the Atlantic Ocean. I think they could do it right in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, too. You know, that's where, you know, time, the new day starts or whatever. I don't know. You know,
I like Josh's response to the whole thing, where he says, give me $200 and it's done. Like, he could not possibly care less in this scenario. Everything I read leads me to believe that the whole spy thing is really a veiled reference to Alger Hiss.
Oh, yeah, okay. I suppose so.
It turns out that he, you know, this is a guy that went to jail for a technicality, when it was pretty commonly believed that he'd been a spy. A lot of people protested that he was innocent for a lot of years, and then in the late, I think it was the late 80s, or maybe the early 90s, NSA actually revealed that, oh, by the way, we've been able to read these Russian documents for years now, and they pretty much prove that Alger Hiss really was a spy. What do you think about this idea of the Cold War is over, but we're still trying to hide the fact that we can read these ancient decryption algorithms from a country that doesn't even exist anymore?
You know, I think that I am okay with us keeping it secret.
Okay.
Because who's to say what they might try and reuse something down the line?
Or someone else might get a hold of and try and use.
Right. Yeah. I'm okay with that. You know, as long as we remain, you know, separate sovereign nations that don't fully trust each other, I'm okay with it. The whole storyline through this episode is the fact that Sam wrote, you know, as part of his, yeah, I guess,
doctoral thesis.
Was it his doctoral thesis or master's work or, you know, something relating to some massive paper that he wrote? He goes on for, you know, 30 pages about this particular guy. Based off of the information he had, it literally looks like this guy was innocent, and that they, you know, drug his name through the mud, and he was wrongly imprisoned, you know, for that time, and that, you know, he really shouldn't have been a spy at, you know, he's not a spy, and we should stop thinking of him as that. And come to find out, as, you know, Nancy McNally finally has to do with him, is say, Look, he was a spy. We know he was a spy. Here's the evidence of it, Sam. And you need to drop this.
Okay. So my follow-on question to this is, why not pardon the guy? What does it matter at this point? He's been dead for a long time.
Because if it ever comes out, I'm not in favor of pardoning the guy.
Okay.
At all. It's clear that he was guilty of something. You know, they got him for perjury.
He died in prison, right?
They got him for perjury, and, you know, he went to prison for that. And that's really what it was he was going to be pardoned from, because they never,
convicted him
or tried him as a spy. Right. So there's no way to pardon him for that.
Right.
I don't see the need to pardon him for...
I don't necessarily see the need to do it, but I also don't see the harm in it.
Why do it?
Because it makes a person happy and it costs you nothing.
Really? You're going to make that argument? That seems weird.
I'm just saying, it seems inconsistent with the character of this White House to not say, oh, we're just going to pardon him anyway. If it ever comes out, we just say, you know what, we pardoned him so that we would not be revealing that we could read this signal's intelligence.
Yeah, but they've already done that by not revealing or not convicting him of treason for being a spy. The strongest argument for me is the argument that Sam makes, you know, although veiled in the fact that he's really railing against his father, is the fact that, look, it was treason. You know, he was fighting against a country that, you know, was really trying to protect him. And, you know, hey, here's the name of this woman that died because she was about to reveal who he actually was. And the Russian government had her killed because of it. So, yeah, I think that's reprehensible. And why should you pardon a guy for that? Okay. Just to be nice?
Well, because it doesn't... Who cares? Who cares if he's pardoned?
Have you secretly gone pink? Are you a liberal bleeding heart?
Probably, but I'm just saying the pardon at this point doesn't matter. Whether or not he's pardoned doesn't matter to anyone except for this person. This one girl and her, one woman and her father. That's the only people that care.
And not to make the joke this time, I am a little surprised at your response with this, considering your... what I know about your belief about truth, that you would want the truth to be known, and to do that would be in sort of dishonest. My bigger question is...
I disagree. Because a pardon does not mean we didn't think you committed the crime. That's not what a pardon is. A pardon is saying, we know you committed the crime, you've been found guilty of it, we don't care, we're going to let you off the hook anyway.
Not necessarily.
Okay, that's how I interpret the word pardon. I don't see a presidential pardon as being anything other than, yeah, you were guilty, but I'm president, I'm just going to let you out. And if you're going to do it, just do it for everybody. Do it for everybody, especially in these cases, specifically in these cases, where it costs you nothing, because the guy can't do anything at this point. He's dead. He can't hurt us anymore.
Yeah, that's where I say, what is the point in doing it, considering the fact that he is dead?
I see it as a meaningless gesture, and fine, make a meaningless gesture to make a person happy.
Yeah, you're doing it for the daughter, not for the man himself.
It seems an awful lot of paper pushing and government waste to bother for someone's feelings.
Okay.
I couldn't.
I don't see that it needs to be that much paper. You just go out and say, okay, we pardoned XYZ.
I think there's a bit more paperwork to do. I don't know the system, but the way that they described it here, Sam had been spending a long time going through this. That's government money that was being spent on it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Instead of Sam wasting all this time, just say, yeah.
Just say.
They're dead. Pardon them. Who are we hurting?
Oh, what about the family of the woman who was killed?
Not pardoning him is not going to make her come back to life. You're not punishing that guy anymore. All you're doing now is you're punishing completely unrelated people.
I don't see how you're punishing anybody at all. The guy was guilty of perjury. He was old. He died in prison. But and, he had a stigma around his neck that he was, oh, was he maybe a spy?
Now you have some people living in some kind of weird, bizarre, for whatever reason, emotional anguish for a crime that no longer has any meaning to anyone.
Then why not pardon everybody who's dead?
Sure, absolutely.
Oh my gosh!
Who cares? Let's pardon Adolf Hitler. I got no problem with it.
Oh my gosh. I'm done. To me, I'm ready to move on from this.
To me, it's a meaningless act. So you just give it to him. A pardon doesn't mean anything to me. Okay. Moving on.
I do have to say this is one of the only times that Sam's misplaced unilateral actions doesn't bother me.
Like, this is one of the few times where it does bother me.
Really?
Yeah. Like, it seemed like a good course he was going on. When it turns out that he's wrong, he corrects it. Whereas some of the other times, he's like, no, you know, I'm going to continue on my course and just make the entire White House look stupid.
It's not the unilateral action that you're okay with. You're more pleased with the way he handles it when he turns out to be wrong.
Yes.
Okay.
Protesters and rabble-rousers. As we have the storyline with Toby, I was a little annoyed that they just wrote this off. Or they just wrote that Toby won and did this amazing thing. Oh man, you guys should have seen Toby. He totally kicked butt. He turned that crowd around. And we get to see nothing of it.
We get to see him reading the paper with his feet up on the table.
Yeah, I was just like, you know, what's the term for that? Where they just completely ignore the, you know, what actually happened and we just have to take it at face value. Isn't there a term for that?
There is, but I can't think of it off the top of my head.
I was disappointed at that because I would like to see this impassioned speech and the way that he managed to turn them around. He's right. When it comes to the WTO, World Trade Organization, I think that he is absolutely right. It may be corrupt. It may be giving other people or other countries more of an advantage or other corporations a greater advantage over others. It may cause other companies and corporations to go under. But I think overall, he's right. He's talking to the police officer and he's ramping up and making his point. He comes to, and here it is, free trade stops wars. That's why we want it. We want to get everybody, you know, who's doing this, you know, if we can get them, you know, doing this, then we can fix all of the other problems associated with this later. And I would have to agree with him on that completely. Your tells me that you disagree. So what is it?
I see no evidence that free trade stops wars. In fact, I think free trade starts wars.
Give me side examples then.
Oil. Our attempts to enforce the flow of oil in and out of the Middle East has had a whole lot of impact on wars.
What do you mean? We haven't gotten to war over oil.
No.
We went to war to fight injustice.
Okay. But you're saying that the fact that oil was involved had nothing to do with it?
I don't think so.
All right.
I think that if you get people to a point where you can have economy, then it becomes more beneficial to them to continue with the economy, providing goods and services back and forth, growing wealth, that you get past the idea of, oh, I'm just going to go and take this because I want this.
I don't think most wars anymore are about directly about resources. They're more about ideologies.
It's tough for us to say because we don't really have the cut and dry wars that we have in history.
That's true.
You know, yeah. Civil War, World War One, World War Two.
The war on drugs, the war on terror.
No. I would have bought the Grenada War. The war on Grenada. It just, those were very clear cut kinds of things. And, you know, other historical wars going far, far back.
The Battle of Thermopylae.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. It's tough for us to really signify and say, okay, this war is over, and we're going to have peace for the next year or two. Oh, and then another war happens. Fighting wars congruent, like, over the top of each other.
Have you ever seen the movie Wag the Dog?
Wag the Dog? I have seen part of it, and I know what you're talking about. I believe they create a fictitious war in order to divert attention away from some scandal that happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like maybe some of the stuff that's going on is because the government finally clued in that as long as there's the threat of war, that the citizens stay...
sheeple?
I've heard that theory before. I would tend to believe much stronger in humanity than that. The people who are in control have a greater sense of humanity than to put people through that.
See, I don't think it's happening, but for the opposite reason as you. I think it was Santayana who said, I'm trying to remember the quote, but it essentially says, you know, it's more likely that people are stupid than that there's a massive conspiracy going on. Don't ascribe to malice anything that can be explained by stupidity. There it is. Thank you, Aaron. Yeah, that you know, there's no way that they're smart enough to pull off this kind of like extended coup of the American government. It's just, we're stupid. We're dumb. We're dumb enough to keep voting them in.
I'm willing to believe that wholeheartedly. My question... Did Josh do anything that day?
No, he got out. He got out of it somehow, didn't he?
I don't think the man did any amount of work.
Yeah,
like he just kind of went to the big block of cheese meeting, then kind of moved on. Probably did a little stuff here and there, and then showed up for CJ's.
Yeah, he did the map
meeting, and then he eventually wandered on over to Toby's thing, and eventually came back with Toby.
Yeah,
he didn't do anything.
Wouldn't that be nice? Every once in a while. I'm not saying all the time, but every once in a while to just be able to have a day that just disappears in your employer's books. I cherish that idea. That. Every morning I think,
I believe we call that
day.
I believe we call that vacation. You can take a vacation.
Yeah, maybe it was his day off and he just came in anyway.
Hang out.
Well, to see his friends in action on Big Block of Cheese Day. Like, to see their discomfort and lavish in it.
Yeah, maybe. Any other comment? Do you guys have anything else you want to talk about?
You know, come to think of it, the last Big Block of Cheese Day, Josh didn't do very much either. He wandered around and moaned about the card that he was given.
Does he? Yeah, maybe. Seemed like there was...
Leo gives Josh a pass on Big Block of Cheese Day.
Really? Yeah. Kind of seems like he maybe does. Yeah.
Maybe on the first one he bungled it so much that Leo was like, don't give him anything.
Okay, can't do that anymore.
All right.
Got listener comments?
Yeah, sure do. Listener Jim says, my favorite part of this... Big Block of Cheese Day returns. Excellent. My favorite part of this episode is the Toby plot. I like the way he listens to the police officer. Can people make a difference in his thinking? Give him a new perspective. He tells her, you're bothering me. I like that. He appreciates being challenged. How often do I forget to appreciate being challenged? Too often. That's it.
Okay. Your friend John Madsen had a little bit to say here.
Episode 16, somebody's going to jail. That's what it's called, right? Once again, Pete can vouch for me. I was busy doing other things during the airing of this episode when we were watching it. And in the email, people like, any bets on who's going to the emergency room and who's going to jail? I actually officially saw this episode, and I still don't know the answer to that. My guess was that Toby was going to jail, but I don't think he actually did. So I don't even know. I'm not even qualified to comment on this, I guess. But I do say the cartography thing is really fascinating. I think we should look at different maps, look from a different viewpoint. My viewpoint, I would love to put the pole of the Earth right through the equator, make that the top of the map, and then have Antarctica right in the very middle of the map. And I'd love to see what that map looks like, because I'm sure it looks like some kind of alien world. And I think that would be worth checking out. Anyway, have a good show, guys. We'll talk to you later. Bye.
I'm not even sure I understand what he's trying to say he wants the map to look like. Did you understand it?
I think what he's trying to say is, you know how we have the globe.
Right.
And it's always, you've got at the top and the bottom, the Arctic.
North and South Pole.
And the Antarctic.
Right.
And so you have in the middle the rest of the continents. He's saying, switch that on end so that the poles now go through the middle of the equator. And so what you would see would be the Arctic and Antarctic, and okay. You would rotate like this.
And all the other continents would be like at the fringes of
yes,
the map. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Which, by the way, there are those maps. So you just get a map of Antarctica, and then you can see just like the very rim edges of the other continents around. I've seen those maps before. To answer your question, John, nobody is going to emergency and nobody is going to jail. I think the point of this episode, or at least why they call it this episode, is because of the music from the Eagles, which is everything can change.
From the Eagles or is it from Henley? So my understanding from the Wikipedia article on the song A New York Minute is that this is a song that Don Henley wrote and originally released during his solo career.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They covered Under the Eagles, but the version that we're hearing on the episode is the single version that he recorded when he was solo.
Right. Okay. Okay. Good to let that be known. So the whole point of it is, I think, the term, you know, in a New York Minute, anything can change.
Yeah.
Everything can change. And that's what we see going throughout this entire day. You know, CJ, you know, thinks that this is going to be absolutely stupid. By the end of it, you know, she's thinking, oh, wow, okay, this, maybe there is something to this, you know, these cartographers. Toby, you know, changes his mind because he was just going in there to, you know, ignore these protesters. And it's not going to do a darn thing, but because of this police officer, you know, he changes. And Sam, with, you know, he's got a full head of steam and, you know, he's fighting the injustice to get Daniel Galt, you know, take the stigma away from him, and son of a gun, you know, he actually was a spy and everything now is going to change for him. And so that, I think that's what the episode's all about.
Okay.
So, John, I apologize. I was using that for comedic license. No one actually went to jail or to emergency. ratings. So we're back up at the top of the list here. I really, really enjoy this episode. I've mentioned at the beginning, I think that the speech that Sam gives where he goes off and, you know, is essentially lecturing Donna, you know, as he's building up this head of steam to go and tell this evil woman who's got this horrible grandfather. And, you know, he makes the Freudian slip where, you know, he brings his father into this. And Donna helps kind of focus him back and say, you meant grandfather, not father, right?
Yeah.
Sam. And that is just a really, really brilliant scene with all of that stuff. I love it a lot. So I'm going to give this an 8.
I'm going to give it a 7. I do like it a lot. It is a big block of cheese day, and that's like one of my favorite concepts from The West Wing. Is the whole idea of having a big block of cheese day. But ultimately, nothing ever happens from it, right? I mean, everyone gets converted to whatever argument they were hearing for the day, but there's really not ever any lasting change.
Right. It's definitely a standalone episode for sure.
Yeah.
Not really pushing any of the other storylines necessarily ahead far.
And following, I think, right on the heels of three so closely integrated episodes, mm-hmm. I think probably affected me a little bit.
Mm. I split the difference, gave it a 7.5. I definitely like seeing the future Mrs. Toby Ziegler. As the cop seems, he seems to really like the cop for her tenacity. Yeah, good show.
Okay. Thank you very much to all of the people sending comments, especially listener Simon and Flamingo. It was really very nice of you guys to do that. I'm glad you did that. I enjoyed it.
I hope we gave them the due credit, your comments that they really deserve, because you both put a lot of thought into that, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. And the same to Mandy and listener Jim and my friend John Madison, the father of this podcast.
Well, that brings us to the end of another episode of the Homestar Me Presents Trek West 5. We hope that you've learned something, had some laughs, and we always invite your comments to our email at trekwest5@thehomestarme.com. Or you can tweet us at #trekwest5 or call and leave us a voicemail at 801-788-4913. So until next time, I am Joey,
and I am Peter,
and thanks for listening.
Only son, it's good to see you again. So good to see you again.